Okay, good morning. A great pleasure from Global Vision welcoming everyone here from the UK, from central London, by the way. I'm just in case you're wondering where I am today, near London Bridge, and can't get more central than that. Yeah, so London calling, as I say. So basically, yeah, welcome everyone to this year's Eschatology Roundtable. And in particular to our guests from abroad, we got David Livingston from Montreal in Canada, we got Vajdi from Jerusalem, and obviously different parts of the UK being represented here. So welcome everyone, and Assalamu Alaikum. Let me firstly talk about the speakers and the agenda. All speakers have been allocated 30 minutes each. We're up to 30 minutes. There will be a Q&A session or two. So hopefully, inshallah, this time, with especially this technology, we hope to open up the discussion, which has been recorded, obviously. In the morning session, after me will come Clive Menzies. So Clive will be speaking on morality, money, and the Great Reset. That's the topic he's wanting to speak on. Then will come Tony, who's online just now. Tony from Bristol will be speaking on, he's come out with new books, which is amazing and intriguing, dare I say. So his title is Heaven Under Siege, Beginning of the End, COVID-19, Psychological, Economic and Biological Warfare. Sounds fascinating and obviously very relevant. And then we have David Livingston, all the way from Montreal in Canada, who will be speaking on the Book of Revelation, Blueprint for the New World Order. So that's the morning. That brings me to, which I forgot to mention, the title. So the title of the Eschatology Roundtable this year is called The Plandemic. I think everyone gets a message that, from a Global Vision perspective anyway, we do not, indeed we've had a 3-hour or a couple of hours internet interview with some American Muslim scholar explaining that, the concept of the plandemic, not the pandemic, and then the global reset and the dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order and preparation for spiritual warfare. So that is the theme this year. And it builds upon previous events last year, like Jerusalem, Jesus, Imam Mahdi, Dajjal, coming kingdom of God, then World War III scenarios, future of humanity the year before, and the year before global nuclear war and future of humanity, and before that, eschatology, interfaith, comparative perspectives. So what I want to say as introduction for this year and before the first speakers is that Global Vision 2000 is pleased to organize the 6th Eschatology Roundtable that we've done. Also, dare I say, for the first time ever on the Zoom platform. And hopefully this is a breakthrough, if it goes well, to reach a global audience. Already there are good signs with a person, Vajdi from Jerusalem, and David from Canada already. So the main thing I want to say just now is this event, virtual event, whatever you want to call it, is taking place at a time of unprecedented changes, which is hurtling the world into uncertainty, dare I say chaos, and turbulence. We're in uncharted territory or waters. And since last year's Eschatology Roundtable, the world has changed. That's not rhetorical. It's changing all the time. So what's changed? Well, something called COVID-19. And in its wake, we've had lockdowns connected to the same event or phenomenon. And with that has come social distancing, masks, and God knows what else, bubbles. But that has now in turn led to an economic meltdown by definition, that will lead to financial and monetary crisis. And the UK alone, according to the media, or some media reports, it's been said it's the worst recession in not 30 years, but 300 years. It's not my analysis, it's in the media, that report. And talks about a 20% contraction in the economy. Obviously, depends which source you take. And this has led to, not my term, a global reset. Where did that word come from? World Economic Forum. A guy called Schwab, is it Schwab? Yeah, someone will give me the full name again. So indeed, we could have had a whole event on what on earth is this global reset, because there's documents on it and they're talking about it. So that's why this year's Eschatology Roundtable made sense to focus on the plandemic, the global reset and the dawn of the Dajjalic New World Order and preparation for spiritual warfare. The other words might be known and bandied around by other organizations and sources, you know, not pandemic, plandemic, global reset, new world order. They're not new, really. But preparation for spiritual warfare. No one's talking about that. Because do people really understand what we're dealing with? And that is a very pertinent question. Okay, so that's some of my general comments, some specific comments. To me, it's quite clear that, or from a global vision angle, I mean, I pontificate on this on our forum, which is now, alhamdulillah, reaches hundreds of thousands of people. I talk about the cyclical battle between the forces of good and evil, and that we have entered a final phase, if you want to call it. So that's one comment. I did see at one of Simon Mowat's events on eschatology last year, with Clive, that some sort of cosmic cleansing is coming. I knew what I meant, but I didn't know about the pandemic, to be quite frank. But I used that term over a year ago, the coming of a cosmic cleansing. And maybe this year what's happening is beginning to illuminate that term. So that's that. The other thing I want to say is that it's quite clear that these events are being accompanied by these events, I mean the pandemic or plandemic, beg your pardon. There is also a build-up of war, basically, globally. We monitor this, I'm sure some of you too, but there are various flashpoints in the world right now that are actually in a state of war or ready to go to the next stage. And that includes places like the South China Sea, the Indo-China-Pakistan border, Indo-China-Pakistan-Afghan border, and then the Middle East, obviously. And dare I say, Europe's not going to be scot-free, Russia and NATO. So the other point I want to make is, we can discuss this, is a global coup d'etat happening? By who? By dark forces, from my perspective, who are busy during this so-called lockdown. Certain people aren't under lockdown. It's like me controlling this Zoom meeting. Whilst all these lockdowns are happening, there are certain people, moving joysticks to move the world in a certain direction. So my question, just posing it out loud, is there a global coup d'etat by dark forces who are centralizing power, authority, control and wealth happening? A practical illustration of that is, why is Amazon, I hope the figures I'm given is correct, at a time when small businesses are being, an elephant, an ant scenario, when small businesses are being crushed, like ants by an elephant. Why is Amazon just in the UK hiring 2,000 people a week? Is that a coincidence? So that's something to think about. And then our global vision analysis, because we have been active for decades, really, like some of the other people here. Is this part two of part one? What are you talking about? Well, in 2007 and 8, we had the global financial meltdown. And we know what they resorted to deal with it. It was bailouts of banks like RBS, then God knows who else. And quantitative easing, austerity, dare I say market and currency rigging, trade wars, basically kicking the can down the corridor. So basically the point I'm making is, has that now crashed basically, the solutions they had to keep the show going? And also, has the other, talking about things like, you know, confinement to our houses, has the notion of the global war on terror, has that now been transmuted into the global war on the virus? Or indeed, one can argue, like in mathematics, two circles, have the two come together? The global war of terror and the global war on the virus. It's like two circles interacting. Have they come together? As opposed to one replacing the other. Something to think about. And also, from a global vision angle, my position is on our website and our editorials. We openly talk about a pandemic. And I think I've got a duty to say why. Well, we had a whole interview on this with an American imam over the summer or autumn. And the evidence I gave, I didn't even talk about medicine and health. The reason I gave for calling this a pandemic was pre-knowledge, pre-planning, like 9/11. You'll say, what are you on about? Well, if you look at the CARES Act, C-A-R-E-S, passed by the US Senate or parliamentary system, it was first brought into the US system January 2019. That is a fact when you do your own research. I'm on video and on internet saying that. And then Corona, as far as we know, didn't start in January 2019. The act was about Coronavirus Relief Act, you know, to bail out basically the big boys, although they were saying to bail out the people, but it was really to bail out the banks and others. When was it passed? March 2020. When this whole thing started closing down the economies. So that is my argument, that COVID-19 is not just, I mean, there's something happening out there, I don't want to go into that, but it's not just some sort of pandemic or a health-related thing. It is planned or pre-planned, and that's why I call it a pandemic. That, I rest my case, that's my argument. And why have I brought in, I've got a duty to say in the last few minutes, why have I brought in the notion of spiritual warfare? Well, under this pandemic, which I've just argued, how come, well, all religions, their temples, churches, mosques, gurdwaras were closed under this pretext? And in the Islamic case, because I believe Islam is going to be singled out, how come the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage in Mecca, Medina, in my view, was closed down? The Saudis gave the fig leaf, oh, we're allowing 1,000 people to do it. Well, you get 2 million people, mate. By mate, I mean King Abdullah, who normally come. You normally have, Sir, Your Highness, Your Majesty, 2+ million people coming from all over the world, and you claim that the Hajj was still allowed by 1,000 people? That is a misnomer. I would argue an Islamic eschatology talks about this, that the Hajj will be abandoned. I will argue that under the pandemic, spiritual warfare has started. How come the annual duty for universal brotherhood, for upholding the God of the worlds, was sabotaged, was abandoned this year? That is a fact. If that's not spiritual warfare, I don't know what is. I'm just about to finish. And also, if you link that to the sanctity, like in France, the Prophet Muhammad being a focus of cartoons again, you know, mockery of sanctity. Muslims do not mock Moses, Jesus, or whoever. But in France, the mockery of sacredness and sanctity of the Prophet Muhammad is deemed to be upholding freedom of religion. Really? That's obviously led to uproar in the Muslim world. So if that's not an attack on spirituality, I don't know what is. I think I've said my piece. And the final comment I want to say is that it looks as though the Dajjalic, which is really means satanic, world order, new world order, is developing weaknesses in not just the Islamic spirituality and tradition, but all spiritual traditions. You know, people, it's difficult for them to pray, yeah, to put it crudely, and practice their faith and come together to worship the Lord of the worlds. And it looks as though, and I've said this from a global vision angle anyway, I believe that the Dajjalic system, which controls the world, wants their man to come out in the open. That whatever's been happening in the shadows, because it's the end time, they want their man to come out in the open, like an emperor. Yeah, if you don't want to use the word antichrist or whatever, I think the notion of an emperor, you know, a world ruler, they want him to come on his stage and they want to build a temple. That's why Jerusalem's important. They want, you know, they want him to have his palace, a palace, to use a secular term, a palace. They want to install a god emperor. That comes from the Roman tradition. A god emperor. He's actually going to say, I am God. Some of you might laugh at that. Well, we'll see. We'll see who has the last laugh. So that is my perspective from a global vision angle. And that's why the situation we face as humans from all traditions is a battle between good and evil. And the world right now is being divided into those two camps. I think I've said enough. I think that summarizes my latest thinking. So without further ado, Clive, are you there?
Yeah, hello? I'm here. I'm ready.
Okay, Clive, we're at 12 o'clock. That's fine. I've done my spiel. You've got half an hour. Please introduce yourself as you wish. And you kick off the event as the first speaker on the theme of morality, money, and the Great Reset. Please introduce yourself, please.
Many thanks, Maureen, and hello and welcome to everyone. Introducing myself, I suppose I've been on a journey of discovery, which has really sort of, it started probably 20 years ago, but really started to take form about 10 years ago with the formation of critical thinking in 2012, beginning of 2012, 9 years ago. And that was a research and analysis project to try and understand how the world works and essentially to answer three questions: who rules, how, and why. And we actually concluded that work in October 2019, and essentially the analysis and all the information is available on freecriticalthinking.org for people to go and look at. Since then, I've really been focusing on two strands, one of which, or both of which, Moeen has touched on. One is the spiritual nature of our enslavement, and that has involved an exploration into esoteric knowledge, which predates most of the religions and is, in my understanding, the root of all religions, whether you're talking about Islam, Christianity, Judaism. They all have their root in Hermetic philosophy and ancient wisdom. So that's one strand of my work, although I continue to monitor and try and analyze current events in the context of critical thinking's analysis. The other strand is very much on a focus on what we do about it. And critical thinking's analysis really came three fundamental flaws, being hierarchy, theft of the commons, and usury. And it's really the focus on money, because money power rules everything, that has really concentrated my work over the last 12 months or so. And I will cover that in my presentation, so I won't say any more than that, other than to say that all of the incentives and penalties, we're not talking in the main about evil people. We're talking about people responding to the incentives and penalties of the political economy, which are actually shaped by the money system. And that's why the money system, if you like, is the key to our salvation or our escape into a better world. It is also the mechanism by which we're enslaved, which is why this talk is being presented under the title of Morality, Money, and the Great Reset. When Moeen asked me to speak, he did say that he was quite keen to put this in the context of the Great Reset, which is what I'll attempt to do. So before I begin, I'm just going to put a number of links in the chat, which you don't need to look at now, but they're there as and when you need them. And essentially, I'm going to refer to these as I go through my talk. And I suppose the story starts, the story started in terms of what is currently happening at least 2,500 years ago, and I'm going to come to that a bit later. But the story of money really took a turn in the Christian world in the 15th century when a scholar called Marcello Ficino, I think his name was, translated the Corpus Hermeticum from Latin, from Greek into Latin. And what he probably couldn't have anticipated, and the link, the first two links that I put in the chat relate to the previous talks I've done. So one from December, Global Vision Roundtable, and one from January. But the third link is something called On Principle and Interest, Hermetic Magic and the Lords of Time, written by Colin Mackay at his site, psalmistist.com. And really, in our investigation of how the world works, I found this essay, which is quite long and complex, and I've had to read it a number of times. Really, it is quite revealing, because actually money, or usury, interest on money, is the manipulation of time. And I would urge everyone who's interested in such subjects to actually read that essay, because it is of vital interest. And essentially, the translation of the Corpus Hermeticum led to the emergence of double-entry bookkeeping. And what double-entry bookkeeping did was allowed bankers to obscure or hide their crime of usury within a set of double-entry books, as it were. And obviously, in the Christian world, usury was outlawed or prohibited, but double-entry bookkeeping enabled them to make their usurious profits look legitimate. And this ability to manipulate time is an extremely powerful mechanism. And that essentially has given the power of money to basically dominate all conduits of power, all the levers of power. Because if you can create money from nothing, you can buy politicians, you can buy media, you can buy military might, you can buy anything you want, and you can buy the minds of the human public, which is effectively what has happened in the past progressively, particularly over the 20th century, and it's accelerated in the last 20 years. And so that is why money is such a key subject for people to understand, and I'm going to go into money in a bit more detail later in my talk. Now, I said this all started 2,500 years ago, and the next source on the list, the fourth source, is The Controversy of Zion, written by Douglas Reed. And he was writing in the early 50s, after the war, and he documents the evolution of this ideology of destruction, which emerged or started in 458 with the writing of four of the original books of the Bible. And essentially, he maps out how the narrative in the Bible has been progressively corrupted in the form of Judaism in the Torah and obviously in Christianity in the Bible as we know it today. It's not the Bible as originally conceived. It is also a document that has multi-levels to it, some of them benign and beneficial to humanity, but encoded within them is the ideology of destruction. And I'm not going to seek to explain that, but I think that the Controversy of Zion is an essential reference to begin to understand how this ideology of destruction has unfolded over 2,500 years. And if you want corroboration of that, there's another woman, another book by a lady whose name I think is Mrs. L. Fry, called Waters Flowing Eastwards. And she wrote even earlier than Douglas Reed. So remember that Douglas Reed was writing in the context of the post-Second World War environment, where there was a lot more clarity and honesty on what had happened through the previous two world wars, and he writes extensively on that. Obviously, since the Second World War, we've had the intervention of Hollywood, academia, basically completely obscuring what really happened that led to those two world wars. But both world wars were fomented by money power. Which brings us on to what I would describe as the Third World War, which started on September the 11th, 2001. And that was really the beginning of the war that we're currently in. Now, I wrote an article not long ago. I blog, incidentally, at a site called outersite.org. One of the references is located there. And I wrote this article, I don't know, two or three months ago about how we were in World War III. And one of the people who's been involved in critical thinking said, it's actually World War IV. And he pointed to what happened after the Second World War when former imperial powers, such as Britain primarily, gave independence to many countries across Africa, Asia, and elsewhere. But effectively, there has been a continuous war against those so-called independent countries that were left with poison pills in their independence, where division was fabricated, particularly if you look at India as a case study. It was designed to create conflict. And the conflict that Moeen was alluding to today across the world, particularly in the context of Pakistan and India, that was deliberately created by the British as a legacy. And they've done that all over the world. Wherever they've had power, they've retained that power by ensuring that whatever was left behind was divided and controllable. And economic power was never given to the people of the countries concerned. That is particularly relevant to South Africa, which was given independence under great fanfare, but it never achieved economic independence, and consequently it remained controlled like every other former colony. So leaving aside that, if you like, diversion in my narrative, I'm going to refer to World War III, but I don't think we should forget that there's been a long-running war across the globe since the Second World War, which is all about resources and exploitation of people and their own resources, the commons, as it were. So moving on to World War III, that, as I said, started in 2001 with the War on Terror, which I prefer to call the War of Terror. Those who are ostensibly claiming to be preventing or stopping terrorism are actually the perpetrators of terrorism. You can follow anybody who's done any cursory research knows that 9/11 was a false flag. You only have to look at Building 7. Any sane person would say that's a controlled demolition. If that's a controlled demolition, it was prepared well in advance, and that basically negates anything else that is said about 9/11. And there are obviously many other contradictions and holes in the official narrative. So that was the first phase. The second phase I would characterize, or have characterized, as the climate change narrative, where people were effectively turned on themselves and each other, where basically it was a crime to breathe. I'm not going to go into the whole climate change narrative. We produced a paper on that called Systemic Risk and Climate Change, which I haven't put in the links, but they're is readily available on the sources that I refer to. So that was the second phase. And the whole sustainable green agenda, which actually ties into COVID, and I'll come on to that, was actually the second phase and the foundation for this whole idea that, you know, we should live a much poorer existence than we deserve because we're going to kill the planet. And there is so much fallacy in this argument and the alternative Green New Deal and all the rest of it that I'm also not going to go into, but it's an extensive, complex, multi-level problem which, once you examine it from a scientific, political and economic perspective, again, makes no sense. And that is not to say that I'm pro Big Oil, because actually Big Oil is actually behind this agenda. The same forces that drive Big Oil are behind the sustainability agenda. And I'm not going to go into that in great, great depth. So then we get to phase three, which started in the autumn of 2015. Now, mass immigration as a result of all these wars across the world and economic plunder across the world has led to a huge number of economic and, if you like, conflict refugees that have grown in number progressively since the Second World War. I would argue that much of that has been contrived and manipulated specifically to begin to destabilize Europe and America. That really accelerated in 2015, where effectively the European Union dropped all borders. You had organizations like the Open Society Foundation, ostensibly backed by George Soros, but I would argue that he is actually answering to a higher power, basically funding credit cards, mobile phones, painting a very attractive picture for people who were desperate and had no other means of seeing a better future other than coming to Europe and, in the case of America, migrating northwards. This has been a deliberate policy, and this has nothing to do with racism. This is to do with turning people on each other. And that is one of the reasons that I spend a lot of my time trying to converse and interact with groups from the Muslim community and all other sections of the community, because I think we need to work together to fight this threat of central power, because this is a war unlike any other war. The First World War was nothing like any war that had gone before, because it was the first war on such a scale and across such geographical expanse. The Second World War was a very different war from the First World War, because it was the First World War that specifically targeted civilians. Huge numbers of civilians died in the Second World War. The Third World War is very different to both those wars, because it's a war of central power against everyone. The mass of humanity is at war with a structure that is controlled by very few. So this is why this is World War III, and those are the phases. It is also an economic war, and this is where we get on to the subject of money and its importance in this war. And Moeen referred to the Great Reset, which has been articulated in a book by Klaus Schwab, who Moeen referred to, who was the founder of the World Economic Forum and is the current, I can't remember his title, he's president or something like that. But basically, he's come out publicly talking about the Great Reset, which incidentally, in my previous talk, I referred to not specifically by that name, but I called it the Global Reset. Because if you follow the trajectory of what's been happening, particularly in the world of money and high finance and banking, one could see what was planned. It was announced in 1980 in The Economist. The front cover of The Economist actually predicted this in 30 years' time. The timing is probably not exact, but this is what is underway. And critical thinking has been predicting what is unfolding today. For some years ago, in 2016, I gave a presentation to an organization called the Chartered Institute for Securities and Investment. It's a city-based organization. I was presenting to wealth managers and people involved in wealth management, investment management. There were about 60 people in the room. And I called that Economic Disaster or Salvation, and laid out critical thinking's analysis and predicted what is currently unfolding. 1929 was the last Great Depression that is within living memory. I know Moeen referred to 300 years ago, and it's not a subject I'm familiar with. But we are looking at something of the order of magnitude or even greater than 1929, because the world is far more connected today and the system is far more vulnerable to systemic shock than it was 90 years ago. That is what we're facing at the moment. 2008, we warned in the aftermath of 2008 that what the response, as Moeen referred to, where effectively central banks have been throwing money at the global economy for the last 10 years or so, well, over 10 years now, 12 years, was basically storing up problems for the future. And when this thing went bang, the sound was going to be unprecedented. I referred to this in my last talk, which is the first link in the list of references that I've given. The fifth reference, if my mathematics is correct, no, sorry, I've just done the fifth reference. This is the sixth reference. COVID-19 induction was a paper that we produced after the last conference in July this year. And basically, it describes what has unfolded through COVID. We described how it was planned, laying out how it was described by the Rockefeller Foundation in 2010 in a chapter called Lockstep, how the event was rehearsed on the 18th of October 2019 under the title of Event 201, which involved John Hopkins University, the World Economic Forum, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the usual suspects, all of whom are controlled by money power. And Moeen mentioned Amazon, and we specifically made reference to Amazon, that essentially Amazon is becoming the global commissariat. What we're undergoing is a rerun of what happened in the Bolshevik Revolution and what has actually rolled out in communist China and in Stalinist Russia, an organized, centralized, planned economy. That's what they're trying to do. It will fail, but that's another issue. But that is what is going under, we're undergoing at the moment. And one of the things that we referred to in that paper was the creation of what are called central bank digital currencies, CBDCs. And this is ostensibly the mechanism by which all people will have to access their means to life. In other words, if you don't have access to CBDCs, then you won't be able to buy food, you won't be able to travel, you won't be able to do anything. And if you look at what's been happening in China and their social credit scoring, this is all planned to be tied in with the provision of access to income via the CBDCs. And the deliberate collapse of the economy is going to make everybody reliant on the planned universal basic income, which ostensibly will only be accessible via CBDCs. Now, I've been working, these three papers, they're all built on the work that thousands or even millions of people have contributed to, but Alex Nikoloff and I, who co-authored these two papers, have been involved in, we've now started to engage, Alex has been engaged a lot longer than I have, but I more recently have been engaged with something called the Digital Currency Global Initiative, which is a venture which is involving a UN body, the International Telecommunications Union, and Stanford University. But it involves participants from the UN, from the Bank of International Settlements, IMF, all the usual suspects. And we've just presented something called the Taxonomy of Money, which ostensibly tries to describe and categorize money in the same way that the periodic table categorizes the fundamental elements, molecular makeup of hydrogen, oxygen, and all the other chemicals. So we're trying to do the same for money and exploring it in its creation and in its exchange and its effects. And that paper is published. That's the last reference that I've put in the chat. Now, the context for this is the link before, and that link, John Titus and Central Bank Digital Currencies, talks about what is currently underway. And John Titus, who's a bit of a financial, I'm trying to think of the right term, but he's been investigating and following the roadmap of central bank manipulation of markets and the creation of the current system, and he's predicting a gigantic crash. He corroborates everything that critical thinking came up with and we've been looking at subsequently. So that's the context for the taxonomy of money. But in the taxonomy of money, we only make passing reference to the instability of the money system, because the people that we're talking to, one, believe that everything is fine and the system works fine, in spite of what appears obvious to people on the outside. But also, we're trying to engage with them in such a way that we don't sort of get dismissed as conspiracy theorists or people who are out to attack them. And we're not out to attack them, because we think this is a structural problem and everybody's responding to the incentives and penalties. So this is not an attack on people. It's an analysis and deconstruction of the structure which has created this situation. And the way in which we've been able to do this is through the co-creative learning methodology that we evolved or grew into in critical thinking. And we've outsourced that as a free project for anyone to access at co-creativelearning.org. And essentially, it's the process that has created what we now understand. This is nothing to do with me or Alex or other individuals. It's the collaborative power of the way and the method and the process and the principles that we follow that has led us to these conclusions. And that's why we are trying to use the same sort of methodology to interact within this digital currency global infrastructure, which is obviously compartmentalized, segmented, but we're trying to interact across all of the working groups, of which there are three, and there are many streams to each working group. So we're trying to, if you like, inject our process into what they're doing in order to create a much better understanding of money. The document itself, the taxonomy of money, is currently a highly technical document. And whilst it's understandable in parts, there are bits of it that most people will struggle with unless they're conversant with, one, money and how it works and monetary institutions and processes, and two, digitization and software and security and all those things. So there are some, fairly, if you like, obscure concepts in there, but there is some plain language which hopefully will describe what is going on. And that's an ongoing project that we only submitted the paper last Friday. So we're just at the beginning of this paper. But what we hope to do, and we'll expand that into a much more accessible paper for a lay audience. And what we hope to do is expand these conversations into other arenas beyond the Digital Currency Global Initiative. Because everybody needs to understand that it is money that is keeping us captive, and there are the foundations available and the ideas available for us to create money that will be universally accessible. And if money is universally accessible to anyone who wants to create or participate in exchange, then centralized power no longer has the control over us, because we don't need to comply with their regulations. We don't need to use their money. We don't need to listen to their media. We don't need to use any of the infrastructure that has been created primarily to farm us. The process of farming humans has evolved over 2,500 years. It really began to accelerate and take shape, and I can't explain that in great depth, but the thread of this goes through critical thinking's analysis. That started in the early 20th century. It was propaganda and psychological manipulation that took populations into the First World War, particularly the American population, which Woodrow Wilson was actually elected on an anti-war platform. And yet, because he was in the pocket of money power, he and Edward Bernays, who authored the book Propaganda, managed to persuade the American public that their interest lay in joining in the Second World War in 2016. And this is all corroborated by Douglas Reed's book that I referred to, The Controversy of Zion. So I'm very aware that I'd laid out a lot of information in very concentrated form, which is why I put the references out there. I think I've probably got to the end of what I want to say, other than to say that don't take my word for any of this, but anyone who is interested in why COVID is happening, why it's a scam, why that you as an individual are not under threat from this so-called virus. People are dying from all sorts of things, the majority from what's being done to us, rather than from any virus that has yet to be isolated. Pathologists across Europe have yet to actually find a provable case that can be directly attributed to COVID-19. You are being lied to, you're being manipulated, and the only resistance is to do your own research, and that will give you the confidence, the knowledge not to comply. I have not worn a mask. I every opportunity. And Alex forced behind the last three papers in the taxonomy of money. I'm essentially translator because he's Bulgarian, which actually gives him his Cyrillic language background, gives him an amazing insight into the language. And languages, the language that he uses, like structural violence and plunder, is very powerful expressing this. Alex adopts a five-a-day policy. And his five-a-day policy is nothing to do with eating fresh, it's to do with non-compliance. He will find five ways every day of not complying with the regulations and making it known to others that he's not complying with the regulations. Because people are reluctant to step out, but if they can see others actually not complying, they are encouraged to not comply. And my message to everyone who is interested in emerging from this dark nightmare that we seem to have entered is do not comply and encourage others to do the same. Thank you very much. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Clive. That was very illuminating and enlightening, and also promoting the philosophy of resistance, which we need to permeate throughout the internet and society. Okay, Tony, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, yeah.
Okay, great. Nice to have Bristol from the West Country here. So Tony, ladies and gentlemen, or comrades, is a leading independent journalist and investigator. I've come across Tony initially over the 9/11 work and his website, and he also runs a radio show, a weekly radio show, amongst others. So Tony, maybe you can introduce yourself, but your topic is on 30 Minutes on Heaven Under Siege, Beginning of the End, COVID-19 Psychological, Economic and Biological Warfare. Over to you, Tony. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Maureen. And first of all, I suppose I should talk a little bit about Maureen and I's work on the 9/11 campaign. This really started around about 2003 when Ian Henshaw and Ian Neal in London started to pull together a group. And I first met them, I think it was at the TUC conference, actually. And we then started, I suppose, what you could call a kind of formal UK 9/11 truth campaign. And I think it's great to hear also Clive really focusing on the money side. And this obviously has been something that goes through the whole of history. So my attitude to this is that it's something very similar to the September the 11th attacks. As someone who worked in the early 1990s in mainstream media, my job was as a researcher and as a reporter at the BBC, and I worked in central London. Actually, part of my work was in Broadcasting House, working in places like the News Information Department and other services which were to do with news and current affairs, where journalists were given a bit of time. I was working on documentaries too for a local station, Greater London Radio, and given access to these parts of what they call network broadcasting, network television and network radio, which was based at Broadcasting House. So, you know, going through all that. And what the one thing that I would say is when you get to go in front of a microphone and you're actually broadcasting to potentially millions of people, we had a very popular station in London, extremely popular, Greater London Radio, you think before you speak, and at least you should do. And one of the things I've noticed is that the BBC people don't seem to anymore, the voices I hear and the faces I see, don't have any kind of idea that there might be somebody that might pull them up on what they're saying. They're talking to an audience which is, I feel, completely detached. So they're talking down to people. It's like from an ivory tower. Whereas where I was there in the 90s, there were still many people around who saw it as a public service that they were doing. So that's the main thing I'd say, is that I recognise that an enormous similarities between the cascades of lies that came out after the September the 11th attacks, the attempts to bamboozle the public, just basically beat and smash people into submission through lie after lie after lie, repeated lie. And, you know, as we saw with the 9/11 footage of the collapse of the Twin Towers, for example, the idea to traumatise people. This, of course, is all talked about by Naomi Klein in the shock doctrine, the idea that it's basically like giving people an electric shock and then be able to change attitudes in society as a result. Excuse me, the global war on terror wouldn't have been possible without this. Okay, so Clive mentioned a bit about that, you know, the smoking guns, things like the Israelis hanging around ready to film the Twin Towers and things like that. So one of the things that I've done during this this lockdown, and I've entitled this "Beginning of the End?" Heaven Under Siege, is get out three books as PDFs, which have been commissioned from me for quite a while ago, but had never actually managed to make it into print for various reasons. Publishers having, you know, people die on them and having financial trouble, things like that. So it's a lot of what I'm going to talk about now is about books and about specific books. And I'll put a book list in the, I'm going to put a little Word document for people, which I've put together, which has got a book list on there as well. But I was very pleased to see that right on cue, I've been looking around for a book about the biology of this plandemic. And Greg Felton is in Vancouver, Canada. He's a former mainstream journalist. He now works most of the time as a teacher of English as a foreign language. But he's like me. It may be being elbowed out of the profession because he tells the truth and he serves the public. And Greg Felton has written a book called SARS-CoV-2, which, of course, was the original name of this virus. And the name was changed to take SARS out of the title, which is very significant, as you may read in the book, etc. And it's subtitled Contagion, Collusion, Corruption. And it's actually being printed this weekend, and it's available for the first time next week. So I also pick up on what Clive is saying about farming humanity. I think he's absolutely right. Our cities are becoming people farms. So the idea is that the people in those cities are directed by a higher power, higher force, and there's a kind of sham democracy. I'm sitting here in Bristol speaking to you now, which is a former Templar port, and we have a very strong organisation in our city called the Merchant Venturers, which the families that formed the Merchant Venturers financed John Cabot's trip to discover North America, supposedly discover it, back in 1497. And then once they realized what they had over there, they formed the Society to Exploit America. They then, which led to the genocide of something like 50 million Native Americans, possibly more. And then the slave trade, which the Merchant Venturers was still very much involved with. And incredibly, they're still most active today. We as journalists can't scrutinize them because all of their accounts and details come you can only get them if you're a member of the Privy Council. So it comes under a royal charter. It's almost impossible to scrutinise what they're doing. So I think it's quite clear to me that there is this oligarchy that likes to use the idea of a sham democracy to rule us. And why not, just play with us, do what they want. And in order to change things, they're using psychological warfare, which is why I put in the title psychological warfare is an important aspect of all of this. So the smoking guns of 9/11 we talked about as Building 7. There are others. But here I've identified two in this pandemic. One is the withdrawal of the use of chloroquine, particularly in Europe and the United States by the regulators, the crooked regulators, which led to the deaths, I would believe, of something like tens of thousands of people unnecessarily. Chloroquine was the standard drug, very cheap, out of patent, for use as a treatment of SARS, the first SARS outbreak, and yet it was prevented. Doctors were told not to use it for SARS in the West. Funnily enough, in Africa, places like that, and India, it was used a lot, and many, many, many lives were saved, but not in this part of the world. And that, to me, and that was withdrawn in January in France, in January, middle of January 2020. So that's before the COVID-19 outbreak was really supposed to exist. It was just a little tiny thing over in Wuhan in China. So there, to me, shows some pre-knowledge of what was going to happen, and also to try and make sure many people died, the government authorities doing that. Also, the German government and other governments mandated vaccinations for the first time. We reported this on our radio show in Bristol when we still were on the radio before we got removed from FM. Back in, I'm just looking it up, and I'll put this is in the little notes here, on the 17th of July 2019. So we've got a lot of countries at the end of last year, including China, mandating vaccinations for the first time. And I reported that as quite a scary phenomenon. But apparently there's a movement in Germany that thinks this is fantastic. So these are obviously civil society movements, NGOs, which were preparing the ground for the idea of a mandatory vaccine. Also, the regulators here in Britain, the MHRA, have just approved the Pfizer mRNA vaccine, the gene editing vaccine. The Bilderberg woman, Emmanuelle Charpentier, and her CRISPR people, this is all genetic modification, genetic engineering humans, but they don't talk about it like that. So they're going in, they're genetically engineering your cells to produce the antigen in order to produce an immune response, but they don't tell you, is this going to stay in your blood vessels forever? We just don't know. Also, in the thing I'm going to circulate, there is quite a lot about Robert F. Kennedy's work on explaining just how appalling the Bill Gates Foundation's vaccine programs have been, particularly in the developing world. There's a documentary, just as an aside, there's a documentary called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, which was done by the Swedish state broadcaster. So I interviewed the producer earlier this year, and that explains that the far-right Saimar army, which assassinated the UN Director General, Dag Hammarskjöld, in 1961, was also involved in a fake vaccination program in Mozambique, where they were deliberately injecting thousands, even tens of thousands of black Africans deliberately with AIDS and saying it was an AIDS vaccine, where actually it was just the AIDS virus. They were giving them AIDS. And these sorts of things are very little known, but you would have thought there had been a big outcry about that, particularly from the Black Lives Matter type people, but it was pretty much suppressed. It went out once, that documentary, on BBC Four one evening, and then it quickly disappeared off the iPlayer. But yeah, if people want copies of that, you can get hold of me afterwards. And it's a fascinating documentary, which is devastating. So, psychological warfare. TV and radio. Well, since Brexit started to approach, we've been getting all these American voices on the BBC, not just on the World Service, on the domestic BBC network, radio and on television, enormous number of American voices. And there's a thing called the British American Project for the Successor Generation, which has been bringing together British broadcast producers, editors, managers, and American for many years. And most of you will probably know about something called Operation Mockingbird, which is where the CIA took control effectively of the editorial policy of all the big American TV and radio networks and the newspapers. When I say took control, they've got to leave a little bit of a free hand for journalists in order to make it look like it's not totally controlled. But they're subtly making sure that all the issues that they deem are important are specific issues, are completely controlled by them. So, you know, we've seen no criticism, for example, medical criticism of the response to the pandemic, which is absolutely appalling. It's also led to possibly tens of thousands of deaths. If there was a proper scrutiny going on in the press with professionals allowed to speak, then we wouldn't have had the removal of sick patients from our ordinary hospitals and been putting them back into care homes without being tested for the COVID virus. And again, potentially tens of thousands of people have died because of that decision, which wasn't allowed in the press to be scrutinised because of the very clear guidelines, or they say guidelines, but instructions from the Behavioural Insights team at Downing Street, Ofcom, and the broadcasters were told, this is very serious, this pandemic, you must do what the government says. And because of that, many, many people died. And one of the byproducts was I lost my radio show because I have a rather spineless manager, apparently. Then we got Brigade 77 being used. We just heard a couple of weeks ago that that they are going to be used as part of the British Army psychological warfare units in order to try and persuade people to take a vaccine, which is potentially very dangerous. The MHRA, the regulators last year were hauled over the coals for approving the use of mesh for hernia operations and for women who have incontinence problems, but there'd been no actual evidence that this was safe, no testing done even. no proper testing done, and yet the MHRA approved the use of this mesh inside people's bodies. And there was an enormous scandal about it. And yet everyone seems to have forgotten that. The journalists are not talking about how utterly incompetent the regulators were in Britain this week when they approved the June Rain, who's their chief executive, approved the use of the Pfizer gene editing, human genetic engineering, the first one ever approved in the world, approved in Britain last week. So this is an incompetent organisation, already proven. But it's incredible that the army are being told that they've got to back these people, really. And I would expect that there are a few out there that raise eyebrows when they're told to do this. Also, don't forget, there's a much bigger aspect of psychological warfare, which is the strategic communications world. Having spoken to strategic communications people, these are in private industry where former army-trained psychological warfare officers are then recruited into the private sector, working for people like strategic communication labs, and they then do things like fix elections. They will tell you who's going to win an election. They will make an election one way or another by using their psychological warfare techniques, but it's been privatized. And I've heard anecdotally that officers who are recruited into the private sector from the army can basically add a zero to their salary. So they're on something like 30 grand British pounds. And, you know, and we're talking about anything up to about $500,000 annual salary in the private sector using those skills. So that's psychological warfare for you. Economic warfare, well, the Great Reset is going to be interesting, isn't it, next year? This is almost another smoking gun in a way. The audacity and the chutzpah is incredible. That the idea that you can create a global pandemic, plandemic, and then say, oh, well, because everything's going to get really bad and we're going to have an economic collapse potentially, we've already thought of that, and we're going to have our own new system replace the IMF, the World Bank, and the global infrastructure, financial infrastructure. Fascinating, but pretty cheeky, really. And so I thought I'd have a look here, and I'm going to be looking a bit more at Prince Charles in a minute, but at the evidence here that Prince Charles has been. I mean, this is something from the BBC itself, from the 7th of November 2017. The Paradise Papers, if you remember those, some very good investigative journalism done, digging out a whole load of offshore stuff. I mean, it's very rare that we see these kinds of things, actually. A lot of the accounts and the tactics of the oligarchy exposed, very rare. So the article the BBC put out was Paradise Papers, Prince Charles's offshore investments revealed. Well, that's a fairly innocuous sounding title, but what those offshore investments were, that part of Prince Charles's private estate, the Duchy of Cornwall, it was secretly investing in this offshore company, which was lobbying to change climate agreements. So what he's doing is he's interfering in these carbon trading credit system, something which is going to be rolled out as part of this Great Reset, it looks like. So he's already there in 2017, trying to prepare the way for having a role globally in the global financial system, a new system which is going to be sold on the idea that it's going to be green and an environmentally friendly system which is going to look after the environment. Of course, the downsides of it, which is this is an oligarchy's controlled system, a system of credit where people don't actually have anything of value. This is actually a move from the traditional financial system where people do have something. They actually do possess something of value, like gold or silver is the obvious thing to think of. And that they possess physical currency, cash, which they can use to exchange for that, over to a credit system, which is where they want to go with electronic money, things like that. And more of that is obviously being rolled out now. And that is the ancient Egyptian system. So we're going from a kind of Jerusalem-based Hebraic financial world into a Babylonian, Phoenician, Egyptian empire style money world. That seems to me what the Great Reset is going to be about, you know, for at least looking at it from a bit of a spiritual point of view. So with the obvious thing to say here is that this is Ordo Ab Caio, right? I know David Livingstone has done a bit of work on the Scottish Rite Freemasonry. That's their motto. And the idea is to create the problem and then to come up with the solution. Ordo Ab Caio. To replace special drawing rights with carbon credits or something similar to that. I'm trying to use a bit of a crystal ball here, an intelligent, educated guesswork to see what's going to happen in April. Then I suppose the other aspect of this is the biological warfare side. The Pentagon goes to Wuhan. Well, that was an interesting one, wasn't it? So the gain of function research in the United States was closed down under Obama. Obviously, an absolutely diabolical kind of research. What they're trying to do with gain of function is to find deadly diseases and viruses, etc., and make them go from species to species. So, you know, this is an appalling thing to be even thinking about here, especially since we have a biological weapons ban. This is going on in the labs around the world. So the biological weapons labs, Wuhan, what are the Pentagon doing in Wuhan? Well, I'm going to actually cheat a little bit here and hand over to the guy who I interviewed last week, actually, this guy, Greg Felton. And I'll put some links in our in the document that I share with you, which is the book called SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, because he's done an incredible job, Greg, over in Vancouver, in putting together all of the evidence that this is a man-made bioweapon. Of course, you know, this is something that isn't comfortable for the mainstream media to be looking at, isn't it? You know, because we've seen it's very uncomfortable for them, because we went to war in the Middle East over weapons of mass destruction, and yet here we have the Chinese and the United States Pentagon collaborating on the creation of COVID-19. The evidence for it being a bioweapon is very, very strong in terms of the from the virology institutes, and Greg has that in his book, which is he actually interviewed these virologists at New Delhi University that pulled apart the genome last week in January after it had been published by the Chinese, and explained that you've got these SARS and AIDS spike proteins on the coronavirus, which have been deliberately implanted into it. You know, the idea that this is something natural. They very politely said, well, it's unlikely to occur in nature. Well, that's an understatement. And they did a fantastic job. They then got very much lent on, these virologists in India, but not by Greg. He actually went and interviewed them and got the whole thing chapter and verse. So there we go, biological gain of function, completely diabolical. Okay, so what about the spiritual warfare? Well, this is something I think which only makes sense if you look at it in a very long time scale context. So secrecy versus openness, I think that's what we're looking at. And it's interesting to see how this pandemic is dividing families, is dividing marriages, is dividing the whole of humanity, like a cell dividing, like the sheep and the goats dividing, talked about in the Bible. And you know, what we're seeing really is secrecy versus openness. So people who are prepared to have secret association, secret plans, versus people who have open association, as we are having now. Well, it's reasonably open. You know, that's why I do journalism. So I believe in openness, and I think that's the way to beat this is through good journalism. Really important to understand. One person that's really had a good look at all of the way the cults have worked over the centuries. Yeah, thanks. Is a guy called Tim Cohen, and his book is called The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea. What he does is he assigns the role of an antichrist to Prince Charles. And he says that effectively Charles is the white horse in Revelation. Then we've got the red horse in Revelation being the war. The black horse being an economic collapse. and the pale horse, the fourth horseman of the apocalypse, being disease, pestilence, and that sort of thing. So the key thing about the four horsemen is that this is a very clear signal by God to the whole of humanity who want to listen, that we're living in the end of the world. So that's why I entitled this thing A Beginning of the End, because we know obviously this isn't quite happening yet, but it certainly looks like part of the game in order to create it in the first place, to make it happen. So in that book he talks about Charles, and he gives some very good reasons for it, which I won't go into now, but he's talking about all of his heraldic seal, and also that he's taking a big important role in this great reset. Ultimately, though, he says that he believes, and he's a Jew who converted to Christianity, he says that ultimately Charles will be a sort of Israeli Messiah. So not really a Jewish Messiah, because he doesn't fit with the Old Testament version of the Messiah. Only Jesus does. But what is needed is a Messiah to fit in with a Zionist idea of Judaism, a Kabbalistic idea of Judaism. So the timeline, I put that in there too, and I run through some of the important changes over the centuries which have led to the cults and the occult coming from the creation of the conversion of Constantine in 313 AD to Christianity, supposedly. So up until then, the oligarchy was absolutely out there and ruling things, and then it went underground in 313 AD. And then there's all sorts of changes until we get to April 2021, where Queen Elizabeth II is due to retire, if you didn't know, when she reaches 95. Prince Charles will be passing the British throne, it looks like now, to William, and taking on a globalist world role in the Great Reset, which I just spoke about. So my book is actually called The Siege of Heaven, and you can get a free download off my Bilderberg.org website. The subtitle is How Breaking the Grip of Oligarchy Will Unleash the World's Human Potential. And I've also done another one, which is The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is a kind of book of extracts. It's a book of extracts, which are just little clips and snippets. The one I'll finally here mention is something called The Luciferian Philosophy. And this is by a guy called William Cooper, who was a radio host, former U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer in Eager, Arizona, and he amazingly predicted the 9/11 attacks in July 2001 on his radio show, 3 months or whatever before the 9/11 happened. He said there's going to be a massive attack on the United States, and they're going to be blaming Bin Laden. And he was joking that the CIA couldn't find Bin Laden, but a little CNN camera crew had interviewed him. So he knew the way these people operate using psychological warfare and bamboozling the public. So I'll be including that in the paper. That's from the Siege of Heaven Reader, The Luciferian Philosophy. Any general who ventures upon a battlefield, he says, and we are talking about warfare here, spiritual warfare, any general that ventures upon a battlefield without understanding the enemy is doomed to defeat. And I think it better be, it's time for me to leave it there, I think. And thank you, everybody else, for listening, what I'll do is I'll share my little document for you in the chat afterwards. Absolutely. Finally, though, I will mention very quickly Ordo Ab Cao, Albert Pike, very interesting guy, and he basically put together the plans that I believe that the New World Order, the oligarchy, are now working to, in his 200-year-old letter predicting World War III and a final battle against Islam by the nihilists. And I would say the nihilists are basically the Christian Zionists and the Israeli Zionists together will be trying to battle Islam. And that's the war they're trying to push us into now. So thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tony. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Now, Tony, before you move away from you, that was excellent. You again talked about the philosophy, a philosophy of resistance, not just, you know, being observers. The philosophy of resistance was very important, and breaking the power of the oligarchy So those points are very important. And obviously, your counter, the need to develop counter-narrative, obviously, one needs to congratulate you on your efforts through the radio show every week. And indeed, for those who don't know, Tony also runs a website called UK 9/11 Truth. And there's a lot of information there, not just on counter-narrative to 9/11, but also the global battle for truth vis-a-vis the New World Order. Okay, thank you very much. Now, we got a packed agenda. We also want discussion. The next speaker is from Toronto, from Canada. We have got David Livingston. I'm from historically Glasgow and Edinburgh, for that matter. David Livingston, famous Scottish name, but he is speaking from Canada. Thank you very much for joining us, David. David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Good morning, everybody.
Yeah, good morning and salam alaikum. Do you want to... So just to introduce David. David is an independent researcher. I was quite surprised. Tony isn't the only one who's worked with him. So has Dawood Moosa Pidcock, the leader of the Islamic Party of Britain. They've worked in the past. So David is going to be speaking on an intriguing topic, the Book of Revelation, the blueprint for the New World Order. And there was a reference by Tony about Ab Cowell. So over to you, David. You've got 30 minutes.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. So I'm glad that Tony gave a bit of a segue into this discussion. A little bit about myself. I converted to Islam about 30 years ago. It was part of a search for the truth, also a spiritual search. That search led me to try to understand the world we're living in. And I began my search in history, which has resulted now in 5 books. The latest book is a 6-volume work, which is called Ordo Ab Cowell. It's very much not only basically a consolidation of my previous work and a significant expansion on what I've done. So mainly what I have traced is the history of the occult. The world we live in now, we live in a world where after centuries of operating underground, the first successes of the occult secret societies were two revolutions, and that's the American and French revolutions. When, you know, after being basically being persecuted and forced underground for centuries, they finally managed to achieve some degree of political power. And they've been expanding that power ever since. So what is rarely understood is that, it took me a long time to recognize it, is that there is a blueprint, there is a plan to follow. And that plan, one of them, a very significant one, is the Book of Revelation. So I'm going to start by reading Albert Pike, because he was the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. This is a very important tradition within Freemasonry, which I trace in my latest book as well, too. Founded in Charleston in 1801, I believe. And very much was a consolidation of the Masonic forces that were developing until that time. So what this paragraph here is particularly important, because what he is speaking, what he covers here in two paragraphs, is what took me years to uncover, and what mainstream historians are still missing. So basically he says, the occult science of the ancient Magi was concealed under the shadows of the ancient mysteries. It was imperfectly revealed, or rather disguised by the Gnostics. It is guessed at under the obscurities that cover the pretended crimes of the Templars, and is found enveloped in enigmas that seem impenetrable to the rites of the highest masonry. So basically, this is the core. It was this scientific religious absolute, he says, basically talking about the lost word, which was the underlying ideology that led to the Templars, the Rosicrucians, and finally the Illuminati and the Freemasons. So why that's important is basically, so first of all, to do a quick recap, this is founded on effectively the history of the Old Testament. And as you all know, basically the Judaism begins with Abraham. His grandson, Jacob, also known as Israel, had 12 sons. Their sons moved to Egypt. Their ancestors were eventually brought out of Egypt by Moses, and they settled in Palestine. And there they were expected to conquer the known inhabitants, who were known as Canaanites. Canaanites practiced the cult of Baal, which is a dying god cult of a dying and resurrecting god. So what happens is that they remained there for centuries, but because they were warned repeatedly to avoid the worship of Baal, but they went against these commands. First of all, what happens is that at a certain point, Solomon, who's the son of King David, builds the Temple of Solomon. So famous in Jewish and biblical history. And this was supposed to be a magnificent temple, also houses the Ark of the Covenant and so on and so forth. So, but what happens is that as the Israelites pollute their cult, the temple itself becomes basically replaced. It's no longer a temple to the one God, but it becomes a pagan temple dedicated to the various dying, Baal and his sister spouse Astarte. So because of these crimes, basically the Jews are warned repeatedly that if they persist, that they're going to be taken away into captivity. So the first thing that happens is that actually at a certain point, the kingdom of Israel becomes divided in two. So there's the kingdom of the north, which is comprised of the 10 tribes, and then the southern kingdom of Judah, which is comprised of Judah and Benjamin. So the Assyrians come in the early 700s BC and conquer the northern kingdom and disperse the 10 tribes. This is the first of the warnings. The second warning comes about in 597, I believe, BC, when the Babylonians conquer southern kingdom of Judah and take the people, the entire population of Judah, to captivity in Babylon. So this is a time when this is a very important pivotal period. In fact, it's referred to as the Axial Age. And what happens is that during this time, while the Jews are in captivity, they compose probably about 30% of the population. This is the 50-year period when the Kabbalah is developed. What happens is because the Jews are not known outside, basically the Jews are not really basically recognized by much of the rest of the world. After they develop this...
David, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, the people are saying that the slides need to be removed. Sorry for interrupting. Can you go through the slides?
Why? How? I'm speaking to the slide for now. I haven't changed my slide yet.
Okay, all right, fine. Okay.
Sorry, slides are coming.
It's not.
This is just background imagery for now.
Right, okay.
Okay. So what happens is that these Jewish Kabbalists basically, in fact, this is described in the Quran. I got this clue from David Pidcock, which has been very important for my research in his book, Satanic Voices. So basically what happens is this is referred to in the Quran as the angels, Harut and Marut, revealed magic to the devils who teach it to mankind, and they attribute it to Solomon. So supposedly what happens is that the Solomon had a number of jinn demons in his employ, and they hid a book of magic under his throne, so that when he died, it was rediscovered, and then that magic was attributed to him. This is very much, maybe not that legend specifically, but this idea of Solomon as a magical king and his temple as being somehow representative of his magical power is what endures through the occult tradition. So they are known to the rest. So basically they mix their, the Quran says that a segment of the Jews apostatize and practice this magic attributed to Solomon, and they know that they are basically selling their souls to the devil, that they are they're giving up on their pretend, they're basically they're giving up on the afterlife, turning back on the afterlife. And they merge their cult with the worship of Baal and the and Babylonian magic and astrology. They are known to the ancient world as Magi, and they're falsely assumed to be worshippers of Zoroastrianism, but the reality is that they are heretical Zoroastrians who practice a particular heretical brand of Zoroastrianism called Zurbanism. And when the Persians conquer Babylon, the Jews are released from captivity. They're allowed to return to Palestine, and that's where they build the second temple. And some of them, not all of them return to Palestine. Some of them go to Egypt, and that's how you get the beginnings of Greek philosophy, particularly the philosophy of Pythagoras and Plato, which is influenced by Orphism and the cults of Dionysus, which was influenced by the Magi. The other trajectory where this is emerges is in Egypt, known as Hermeticism. And it also influences Christianity as what's called Gnosticism. So the other track is the one within Judaism is within a cult called the Essenes, who are basically also inheritors of the Magi. So this is the Essenes is where now you get the occult tradition in Judaism, which is more recognized. And this is where you get the beginnings of what's called the earliest origins of Kabbalah, which is called Merkaba mysticism. So Merkaba mysticism is focused on the vision described by Ezekiel, which has a lot to do with his visions of the temple, but also his visions of God on the throne. So this is not God, the creator. This is the Ancient of Days, which is why he's bearded and old. This is also a remnant of Zurbanism and is Saturn. So what you see here is that Ezekiel sees a creature carrying the throne, and there's four creatures. Each of them have four heads, two sets of wings, the body of a man, and cloven feet. And they're standing on a wheel inside a wheel. So what that stands for is the four heads are the four sections of the zodiac. So the human head is Aquarius, the eagle is Scorpio, Leo is the lion, and the bull is Taurus. They're standing on the wheel inside the wheel is the two equators. So there's the celestial equator and the earthly equator. So of course you know that the earth circles around the sun, but it also spins on itself, which creates the perception of two equators. So that's the astrological basis of Ezekiel's vision. And this is the purpose of Merkaba mysticism, is to attain that vision. So now you have a confluence of occult influences in the ancient world, particularly out of Alexandria. And you get this proliferation of ancient mysteries. And there's a number of them. And they basically are, the most important one of them is the one attributed to Mithras. So this is what I cover in the genealogies that I cover in my book. It's what I call the Mithraic bloodline. As you look at the families that were involved in the spread of this cult, they're primarily the Julio-Claudio dynasty of Roman emperors, the House of Commagene in Turkey, the House of Herod, and I think that's all three of them. So the House of Herod, as you know, is basically the family of Herod the Great, intermarried significantly with all these families. And their descendants, one of the most important descendants is Constantine the Great. And so Constantine, basically what he did when he created effectively Catholic Christianity at the Council of Nicaea, is he imposed a dying God version of Christianity that replaced the original Jewish Reform movement. So where that comes from, basically the cult that he followed was a cult of Sol Invictus, which is a version of Mithraism. So you can see here that Mithras worships Azurvan or Saturn. It's a figure pretty essentially identical to the vision of Ezekiel, with the head of a lion. In this case, there's only one head, the lion standing on a wheel inside a wheel. So what happens at this time is you have a proliferation of apocalyptic literature in Judaism, which is where this tradition comes from. And basically, based on expectations of the end time, but more not expectations of the end time, primarily dealing with revelations imparted to mystics. So this is a pattern which is very popular at the time, and this is why you have St. John. So the book of Revelation basically is a type of literature which is typical of the time, typical of this early occult tradition. And because what's important to remember is that John was an apostle. So when you look at the New Testament, it's founded effectively on four books which communicate the teachings of Jesus. There are additional books that come from Paul. Paul, again, is not a direct disciple. He claims to have had a vision. He's also an agent of the house of Herod, which is why he preaches a brand of Christianity, which is at variance with the Reformed Judaism of Jesus. Now you have this revelation, which is given to John. It's not a revelation that's given to Jesus. It's a revelation given specifically to John. So this is why Albert Pike explains that, he says, the apocalypse, that sublime, cabalistic, and prophetic summary of all the occult figures, divides its images into three septenaries. So this is important, that this happens to be the very same paragraph where Albert Pike reveals his cryptic allegiance to Lucifer. The apocalypse, to those who receive the 19th degree, the apotheosis of the sublime faith, which aspires to God alone and despises all pomps and works of Lucifer. Lucifer, the light bearer, strange and mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness, Lucifer, the son of the morning. Why he's calling us out in the morning there is because typically Lucifer is identified with Venus, and that's where you're going back to the worship of the goddess. So basically what Albert Pike is explaining, the purpose of his book, Morals and Dogma, which is considered the Bible of Freemasonry, is to explain that the purpose of Freemasonry is to rebuild the temple. So as I mentioned, the temple was rebuilt when the Jews returned to Babylon, but it was then again destroyed with the conquest of the Romans in 70 AD. So the goal of Freemasonry, the goal of the occult, is to end the expectations for the end times, is that a third temple is going to be constructed. So the goal of Freemasonry is to build, allegorically rebuild, the third temple, which is why they're called Freemasons. And because they're going to bring about the coming of the Messiah. And that is what they call the great work, the magnum opus. And it's all based on the book of Revelation, which is effectively their blueprint. So what's interesting is that the book of Revelation, you see, repeats the four beasts. And that's the four creatures referred to in Ezekiel. So I've only got 10 minutes left, so I'm not going to go into detail here, but I'm going to just show you the image to make that reference. So the thing is, the book of Revelation is the one part, I think it is the last book that was entered into the New Testament. It wasn't entered until the 4th century, or around 400 AD. And that was after a lot of controversy. Even when it was finally accepted, there were still many who opposed it. And one of the reasons why is that believed that it wasn't actually John who wrote it or received it, but a Gnostic named Corinthus. So this is a fact that Albert Pike himself accepts. He says, thus explained Albert Pike, Corinthus of Ephesus, with most of the Gnostics, Philo the Kabbalah, Zen of Vesta, the Puranas, and all the Orient, deemed the distance and antipathy between the Supreme Being and the material world too great. So this is what Albert Pike refers to, the Oriental tradition that's found in the Kabbalah, which basically traces back to the worship of Lucifer. So jumping ahead, you have several centuries later, the ongoing plan, as I mentioned, of Freemasonry is to rebuild the Third Temple. And this is why you have the Templars are sent to the Holy Land to reconquer it. This is an absurd mission. This is at the time the world is dominated by, at least the Middle East and North Africa is dominated by the Islamic world. But instead of confronting Islam head on, their one mission is to conquer Jerusalem itself. And it appears that what they do is that they conduct excavations of the temple and they uncover a book called the Sefer HaBahir, which then revives the study of Kabbalah. The Bahir basically sets off the history of Kabbalah in modern times, and it leads to the emergence of the legends of the Holy Grail, the Knights of the Garter, and the Order of the Garter, which is basically the Templar tradition in England. And out of that, you get the Rosicrucians. So the Rosicrucians, what's more important there is that it emerges out of a marriage between Frederick the Fifth of Palatinate in Germany, a Protestant prince, who is married to Elizabeth Stuart. Elizabeth Stuart is the daughter of King James. And what you get out of this marriage is you get the descendants of all the most important people involved in modern occult tradition. So you can't read the details of this chart, but I'll go over it quickly. Basically, here you have Frederick the Great, King of Prussia, who becomes the head of Scottish Rite Freemasonry and writes the Conference. So this chart, basically, here you see Frederick the Great. I explain who that is. Here you have the family of Hessen-Kessel. You have Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel, and that's the family where the Rothschilds basically begin their financial careers. Prince Charles is also not only a member of the Illuminati, he's also the founder, he's also Grandmaster of the Asiatic Brethren. I won't go into detail about what they are. Then basically he marries into the Danish family, and his great-grandson is Christian IV of Denmark, who's known as Grandfather of Europe. And it's that family that Queen Elizabeth comes from through her through intermarriage with the descendants of George the Third. Whoops. And here you have this is the family of the Dukes of Orléans. They are basically the founders of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and their descendant is Philippe Galité, who is the Illuminati and one of the instigators, leaders of the French Revolution. So this is the family that basically gives birth to the Rosicrucian movement, that the Rosicrucians are the ones who are involved in instigating the career of Sabbatais V, who declared himself Messiah in 1666. And it's this movement, the Sabbatian movement. So basically, the Sabbatian movement is a formulation of the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria. And what's important about Isaac Luria is that what was new in his version of Kabbalah is that he prescribed that the end times is not something that you wait for, it's something that you have to actively create. So this is why they created the career of Sabbatais V. And from then on, it is the Sabbatians who are they are the ones who create. First they create create the Royal Society, and out of the Royal Society comes the Freemasons. And then out of the Freemasons, specifically, the Sabbatians are responsible for creating Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And as Tony said, the motto of Scottish Rite Freemasonry is Ordo Ab Cal. And what that means is that you, since the end times describe chaos preceding the advent of the Messiah, then therefore it means that you need to create those, that chaos as the precondition. So whatever miseries are described, pestilence, wars, disease, famine, all those things need to be created so that you can bring about the coming of the Messiah. So here you have a picture. There's many ways in which the expectations of the end times have been created. One of them is Hitler. So Hitler, as you know, is basically, he created what's called the Third Reich. And the Third Reich the idea of the Third Reich is founded on the, yes? Somebody interrupting me? So the Third Reich is creating the idea of going back to Joachim of Fuhrer, a saint from a Dominican mystic from, I believe, 1200s or 1300s, who predicted the coming of the process of the end time happening in three phases. And this was directly appropriated by Muller van der Broek. And I've only got a few minutes, so I'm going to go very quickly. So basically, if we skip forward to our time, and the Book of Revelation, much of what's described in the Book of Revelation is a mirror image of the Semitic expectations that are expected by the Muslims. So what seems to be happening is that there's a deliberate attempt, pitting the Christian evangelicals against the Muslims. And what's interesting is that Jay Michelson, who's actually his PhD was on Shabbatei Zvi, he wrote an article in the Daily Beast a couple of years ago, and he identified exactly this problem. He says, indeed, as a student of millennialism, for some time, it was shocking to see the congruence between the Islamic State's vision of the end times and that of evangelical Christianity. The large battle somewhere north to the northwest of Jerusalem, a final battle in Jerusalem, with the near defeat of the heroic believers of an antichrist figure, and then Jesus appearing from heaven to win the battle once and for all. So this seems to be how the evangelicals are being pitted against the Muslims. And of course, the evangelicals, they are Christian Zionists, influenced heavily by the Sabbateans. And their focus, of course, is the rebuilding of the Third Temple, which is supposed to happen Al-Aqsa, which, of course, is going to be, if it goes forward, is going to be a substantial disruption and an affront to the Islamic world, which will likely outbreak in some kind of global conflict. One of the most important exponents of this occult tradition and conspirators involved in this effort is Alexander Dugin. So Alexander Dugin, basically, he is playing the role of advancing the mirror image of the clash of civilizations, which was articulated by the neoconservatives. And the clash of civilizations, again, is basically another formulation of the Book of Revelation, a preparation for the end times. So if you understand how Alexander Dugin explains it here, he explains how the bringing about the end times actively is a task. He says the end times and the eschatological meaning of politics will not realize themselves on their own. We will wait for the end times in vain. The end will never come if we wait for it, and it will never come if we do not. This is essential because history, time, and reality have special strategies to avoid Judgment Day, or rather, they have a special strategy for a revelatory maneuver that will create the impression that everyone has come to a realization and an understanding. This is the huge arsenal of Heidegger's Noch Nicht and the Eternal Not Yet. If the fourth political practice is not able to realize the end times, then it will be invalid. The end times should come, but it will not come by itself. This is a task. It is not a certainty. It is active metaphysics. It is a practice. And I'll finish there because that's right on time.
Okay, thank you, David. Are you going back to the screen to me? Yeah, passing the screen. Yeah. Okay, thank you. What can I say? That's very deep. To takes us to antiquity and to the present. It requires a lot of discussion, if not a special seminar. Right, Tony. Okay, Tony, Farrell.
Okay, I mean, I think David and I have got fascinating approach, and also thank you very much to Peter. Although I have to, I mean, Peter's sort of saying there that everyone can kind of go along together. I just don't take that. I don't believe that's going to be possible. I think it's going to be basically a division that will be almost impossible to beat. So anyway, but my main point really is about David's excellent presentation. I mean, what he's saying there really is that this Book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic book, and been written by the other side, basically, as a kind of blueprint. Now, I just don't believe that at all. I think there was certainly a battle to keep it out of the Bible. That's absolutely clear. And I've just shared a little document with everybody about the role of the temple in Jerusalem. And this is really key to understanding the Bible, because, I mean, how can the Masons and the Templars and the New World Order be working to a system where Jerusalem has no temple? That's in the Revelation. I've shared that bit in the towards the end of the book of Revelation, where it talks very clearly about the New Jerusalem having no temple. This is quite important. But it seems to me what Pike and his successors have been doing is carefully examining this book of prophecy written by John, who, by the way, is called the apostle that Jesus loved. He was there at the cross. He was the closest apostle, really, emotionally, as a friend to Jesus back in New Testament times. And he was preaching at Ephesus, and he was ejected, as people may know, by the authorities to go and live on exile in Patmos, which is where he had his revelation. And the idea here really is that, you know, Jesus can't just leave everybody in the lurch. You know, a lot of his disciples at the time were really disappointed that he'd gone. You know, they thought, oh, he's dead. We thought he was going to save the world. But then, of course, was the resurrection, and he comes back and he explains a little bit. But John's book is for us, really, is to say, well, this is what's going to happen. And this is a specific message to believers in the future about how things are going to unfold and how they know that it's God that's doing this rather than the devil. So, you know, we've obviously, David and I've got a difference of opinion on who wrote this. But I think the evidence is pretty clear. Pike and his friends have been spending a lot of time trying to twist the words of the book of Revelation to make the good guys seem like the bad guys and the bad guys seem like the good guys. And that this is unfolding in Israel right now, particularly, but obviously in the Christian Zionist movement, particularly in London and Washington, but elsewhere, they are believing that their Messiah is going to be, you know, actually like Jesus, basically. So, you know, they're swapping these roles around. It's almost like a Hollywood movie. You know, they've seen the script and they've just decided, right, we're going to turn our guys into the good guys and Jesus and his people into the bad guys. And that's what we're going to try and run. So they see it almost as a leak, you know, so a leak from the other side, their enemy, and they're going to use that against the enemy. So, and I'd be interested to see what David has got. What
he makes. Yeah, I think, you know, the good thing is we can easily agree to disagree, right? Because it's not so much important what the source of the book Revelation is, rather that it's being used as a blueprint. Right. So that's really what I think what matters in our time is that's what we need to understand is they're using it, the basics of it, to guide their actions, principally preparing the third temple for the arrival of the Messiah. And like you said, you know, they're reversing it, but that's what Gnosticism is, right? They, you know, like you read Dan Brown's book, which is The Lost Symbol, and he ends, you know, this long sort of labyrinth of a story. He ends by pointing out that the lost symbol of Freemasonry is the Bible. Right? So it's the point is not whether or not the Bible is God's truth. The point is that they follow a Gnostic interpretation, which reverses everything. So whereas you and I will read the Bible or the Quran, and we see God as the creator and the one to be worshipped and the commander of good, they see him as the opponent and Lucifer as the liberator.
Yeah, the whole idea of Lucifer right from the start really seems to me be as a kind of counterfeit God. You know, the idea that he's looking at Yahweh, creator of the Old Testament, and saying, well, hey guys, I can be as big as this, I can be as good as this, you know. And that's one thing I think is really also important to stress is a lot of this is negative. negative, isn't it? A lot of it's, oh gosh, it's very doom-laden and depressing. But the Bible makes it very clear in the Old Testament. It makes it extremely clear that the battle is always already won in the spiritual world. That 2/3 of the spiritual beings are angels and only 1/3 demonic. So that's already, you know, basically they're just waiting to take possession of the earth in a way to see how we run things down here. And so I think that's quite a key message. But I would also emphasize, I'd love to ask you, David, what you make of Tim Cohen's prediction, and it actually is very well evidenced in this book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, that Prince Charles, and you know, I entitle my thing The Beginning of the End, the COVID-19, yeah, and the psychological, biological, spiritual war, that Prince Charles might take up this role as a kind of Israeli Messiah. I don't like to use the expression Jewish Messiah, because I think many Jews will reject him as the Messiah. So what do you make of Prince Charles at the Great Reset, you know, going on to become this kind of Messiah figure for Israel?
I don't know. the point I think of, you know, is that if you, it's a long-standing joke about, you know, the not going out into the street and screaming that the end is coming, right? The thing is that people are always thinking the end is coming. it's almost a history of Western civilization is about, you know, various periods of time when people thought that the end was at hand, right? They thought that the end was at hand at the turn of the millennium. The whole mission of Sabbatai Zvi was based on the book Revelation. The book, basically, they chose the year 1666 because it lined up with the number 666 in the book of Revelation. So they thought in their time that they were there. They were at the end times, that they had manifested the arrival of the Messiah. You know, from an Islamic point of view, the Prophet said, he put his fingers very close together and he says, you know, the end times are this close. Right? This is in the 6th century. The end times are always around the corner. And the danger is in trying to read into current events backwards into fulfillment of, you know, of what the stated prophecies. And so this is the danger that we're in now. And this is why there's always political circumstances that can be used to sort of point to, you know, a manifestation of the end times. But particularly right now, this is the danger I believe that we're in. Because this conversation is the same conversation which is happening amongst Muslims, and they're all talking about the same signs. The challenge is that, so there's two things, right? There's political reality, and then there's interpretation of that reality. The thing is, ideologically, we're not going to all agree.
100%.
Right? No. So I think there's some things we can agree on. We generally agree on what's right and what's wrong. And that's why I think, especially in this time, with the plurality of perspectives, we just need to share our understanding, because a lot of what's happening politically, it's pretty clear, mm-hmm. right? So we might be talking about prophecies guiding the actions, but we don't need to determine whether those prophecies are accurate or not. We're just saying that those are the plans being used, and how, you know, sometimes it's just important to understand how people think, not necessarily.
I want to come back to David, though, because he's saying, oh, you know, we've had all these historic people saying in history, even right back to the Roman invasion and the destruction of the temple back in, was it 70 AD? They're saying, oh, this must be the end of the world that Jesus was talking about. But we've got two inventions which have made, the, you know, this kind of revelation, whether it's good or ill. And of course, it will be for good for some and ill for others to take place. And one is television. And this kind of global network of, you know, TVs around the world where people are getting their information, even people who are illiterate, are getting information through TV, which is massively controlled, as we all know. And the other one is nuclear weapons. And those are relatively recent and have made the ability to use fear and threaten humanity to sort of treat human beings like kind of lab rats or whatever, have made that possible like never before. And that's why I found this whole pandemic thing very, very interesting, in that it's kind of, it's using fear and it's using television in a way it's never really been used before to try and control, dominate the world. And that's why I think, you know, we need to be a little bit more alert than maybe 70 AD to something bigger going on right now. Television and nuclear weapons. You know, we've got, you know, the equipment is there for a kind of global tyranny, which hasn't really quite been around. You know, for example, you know, 70 AD or in previous, where people have previously, in the English Civil War, they were talking about, is this the end of the world?
You know, I just think that a point that we need to see first is the chess game that's being played right now, and it's basically the evangelical community in the United States who voted for Trump and who very much steer, you know, basically, I mean, they're the pawns of Zionist policy in the United States, right? And that's really what it comes down to. And so, you know, creating, because for whatever's happening right now, I mean, I'm not sure what the purpose of the pandemic is and what their short-term or long-term goals are. But if the Zionist ambition is to create this third temple and to bring about a global conflict, Armageddon, to accelerate the coming of the Messiah, then really what's important in their plots right now is mobilizing the evangelical community in the United States and then pitting them against the Islamic world.
If I can come in, David, that's very interesting about what you said. But I want to come back to Peter and Tony. It's a pity Clive isn't, for whatever reason, available, because the issue on money and the economy and the World Economic Forum, yeah, Klaus Schwab, these are very central, and because we've got to connect the dots. Wage slavery, artificial intelligence, people in desperation. God knows what. That's a huge debate that should unite 99.99999% of the world's population. How are we going to survive, right, when our, to use your term, Peter, yeah, the means of survival, yeah, are being taken away? You know, just look at Amazon, as I quoted, yeah? Small businesses are being told to shut your business, yeah? But it's okay for Amazon, yeah? And, you know, we're dealing with, I'm talking about a beast. That is a beast with a head, with a head and a dragon. But coming back to something that Tony said, to your presentation, I don't think we should dismiss it. After you, I'm just raising this loud, Tony, yeah? After you hear Peter's, let's call it vision, the natural reaction for many people in a capitalist society is saying, hey, mate, you know, can't you see the divisions are being multiplied? Now, I want to come back to you, Peter. What's your reaction to what Tony said, that, hey, this current situation is dividing all societies, right? And cooperation, well, lovely to have it, but, mate, it's the opposite. What's your reaction to that?
Well, as I say, in my view, that we need to look at our own reaction and solution. And we need to do it as an opportunity to collaborate. If God is oneness, if God is within us, if God is symbolized by the space in which this illusion appears, then we need to say, actually, we have access to the power of God. We have access to the life force. It's running our body. We don't know how our immune system's working right now. You know, we've got 100,000 miles of capillaries full of single blood cells running through our body. So let's be humble and let's say we as individual dreamers know bugger all. But we do know that this adversary that has become super powerful apparently on this planet is planning transhumanism. He wants to inject us with nanobots, and it's going to take over the electromagnetic spectrum with 5G. And a space fence with, you know, Elon Musk and all his satellites and HARP and everything else. And we need to say, right, we are in deep shit right now, and we need to get together. The only way, which is why I mentioned onion rings, the only way we're going to get out of this is to stop arguing and say, I will fight for my onion ring. And if everyone stands up and says, so will I, we are the most powerful force on Earth. We have all, we run Tesco. We run all the multinationals. We just need to put the head off the Hydra and say, we don't need your money. We don't listen to your edicts. We do everything. We dig everything up. We make all the steel. We make all the concrete. We invent everything. Why are we listening to these fools? Only because education is a process of brainwashing, of wage slavery. We need to walk away from the Black Witch and say, we can have cryptocurrencies. We don't need Microsoft. We don't need IBM. In our technical hubs that we can create locally, we've got all the expertise. We need to bloody well wake up.
Can I take you up on that? It's a pity Clive is not here and Alex, they should have been, because they're working on digital currencies. And I also know barter cards. No, but just to pick you up.
We've created a whole platform.
Sure. No, but I'm just saying, have you cooperated or contacted Clive Menzies and Alex Nikolov? Do you know them?
No, not until today. I mean,
we're trying
to give this software system away through licensing.
Well, they are working on this. I don't know why Clive, something obviously happened, but perfect for you. I will put them in touch with you. They are working on digital currencies. I think people need to collaborate, as you said, who are working at different levels. You're at the community level, they're maybe at a different level. But coming back to Tony, and you, Peter, you said we're in shit or holy shit, to use a common parlance. Now, Tony, I mean, what is your reaction again to what Peter is saying? I think it's a very vibrant, yeah, discussion. Okay.
So I think we're going to have to agree that opposing the eugenicist plans, and that's, I think, what may be well behind a lot of this, is the idea of being able to inject people. This is one of the things I found very, very interesting about this new Pfizer vaccine they've approved, which is supposedly everybody is going to be taking. Now, I don't know if they really will. We'll see next week. But it's two injections, right? This is really important, because the idea is to set up the idea of having another injection and another injection and another. The idea is, I mean, with the polio vaccine, with the cowpox, the original vaccines, you had one injection and that was it for life. These ones, they've decided that they're going to give us one and again and again and again. And, of course, in one of those vaccines, it could be anything. The RNA vaccine we're getting at the moment may not have any effect on fertility. But say, for example, a little bit way down the line, you know, we're going to get another vaccine potentially that does and basically turns the people who've had vaccines into a whole group of millions of people that can't reproduce. You know, this is going back to this whole idea of having a kind of a city of people, you know, that's being farmed by these people, an oligarchy sitting above, you know, deciding that. So, I mean, when it comes to actually how to oppose it, I think number one, you've got to know who you're dealing with. And I've hopefully done that in sharing that thing about the Luciferian philosophy in my document I've sent around to people. But also, you know, obviously we need to have ways of barter and exchange within our own community that can't be controlled by the other side. And how that works, I'm not sure. But one thing I will say is about money is I think ultimately we don't need money. Money is an invention from 2,000 years ago. We can have societies quite happily functioning without it. You know, and we've seen quite a lot of experiments over the last 50 years or so of whole communities that function without the use of money. Where people just Correct. Have what they need. And I think this is a fascinating avenue. Many of those, by the way, were controlled and shut down by the other side. So they're looking at how you have a society with no money, but then they don't want us to have it and for it to be an example to the world. And of course, a really good example of that actually is Libya. Well, obviously they did have money in Libya, but Gaddafi was working towards a society where people were far, far less dependent on money and they had many of the basic needs, housing.
We wanted to introduce a gold
thing like that without having to rely totally
on introduce a gold thing. Gaddafi wanted to introduce a gold dinar. Anyway, money is essential, providing it is issued debt-free and by a central authority that has no interest in making interest out of that issue. And every president and everybody who understands money and would understand, as Napoleon understood when he saw the debt of France, He said the deadly fact here in Reveal, but it is amazing that this monster interest is not has not devoured all humanity. It would have done so long ago had not bankruptcy and revolution acted as counter poisons. It's important that money is there, but it must be issued by Beit al-Mal, the central authority.
I think I believe in giving, not money. I think it's quite possible to completely get rid of money, just as we can get rid of the temple in Jerusalem in the final stages of all of this. We don't need.
I think that if you look at that rationally, Tony, it's impossible to live without money. The problem is fiat money. But hold on, the problem: the world's too big. The problem is fiat money. What we need is a gold, the gold standard, or something. You know, a commodity-based monetary system that works. It's great. You know, we need, that's just life. You know, we trade and people value things and people value gold. At the moment, they value digits on a screen.
Well, I mean,
digits on a screen aren't real.
No money systems work too, but it's just that it's been programmed. We've got to think money, 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 you know.
You need leadership, you need a system, and you need a government.
If I could come in again, because the discussion period's almost over, can I put a question to David from Canada? A very important question. There should have been another guy who advises me often. I'll even mention his name, Philip Bree, who is an expert on what you talked about. This is a problem. The thing is, I don't know his personal situation. Maybe he's got problems, but he should have been here. The point, Peter, that's Peter Forrest in Liverpool, and David, you mentioned collaboration. Of course, we got to collaborate, right? It's a given. It's not just about protest that's happening out there, yeah? People are protesting, but the collaboration it isn't happening as it should, point one. Point two, David, the eschatology about the future, yeah? We do a lot of work on our forum, educating hundreds of thousands all over the world, Muslim, non-Muslim. Can I ask you a question? These people who run the show, yeah? You know, one of their vehicles for communication is The Economist, not far from where I'm sitting, in London, controlled by Rothschild. Indeed, some of the Masonic national lodges are next to St. James, right? And St. James Palace. Now, they have a magazine called The Economist. Have you seen their messaging? Because I'll tell you why. Right now, for instance, in Pakistan, YouTube channels have looked at the you know, the images and the pictures they're given for 2021.
Tim Cohen attended the Air Force Academy, class of 1988, and while there became a Christian in November of 1986. And then not too long after that, having read through the New Testament two or three times, and part of the Old Testament, a good portion of it, I asked God to show me who and what was being spoken of in Revelation 13 because of the really strange imagery there about a beast with feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion, you know, the red dragon, etc. And at that point, of course, I believed enough to where I was convinced, okay, it's all true, but how does this make sense? And so I asked God, and within a month of that, I had actually in my hands the official coat of arms heraldic achievement that matches that imagery, as well as the English name calculation and other things. So basically, within a month of that, God showed me that it not only existed, but it existed now, is literal more so than the church has historically anticipated it would be. And then, of course, I began as well, based on other things that I read in Scripture, to work on what I'm still working on, one of the things, which is the Messiah history and the Tribulation Period multi-volume series. So in 1998, I put out the first edition of a book called The Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, which gives hard evidence on the actual identity of the foretold Antichrist. So I'm not speculating. In other words, I'm basing it around hard evidence that's biblically testable, things that exist now.
Well, yeah, but you mm-hmm. talked to him about God showed me this, God showed me that. Well, hang on, because you know, this surely could just be, you know, your prejudices involved here. You're looking for something, you're finding it. It's not necessarily God even involved. Research doesn't always involve God, does it? It may be you've just turned something up that you wanted to find.
Well, but I wasn't looking for it. That's the thing. You know, I prayed and I asked God to show me. And then I went to, in this case, a weekend Bible study, really a lunch after a Sabbath service at a local pastor's home in Colorado Springs. This was a guy who worked for Martin Marietta at the time, and he and some other engineers there had, and this was totally unknown to me, by the way, when he was explaining this to me, had done a program, I guess in their spare time, to try to figure out how to do a name calculation to calculate the number of the beast, the number of this person who would be the Antichrist described in Revelation 13. And so they did this computer program and they put a database against it of world leaders and royalty around the world. And
so, you know, so this is trying to work out the number of 666.
And somebody else was doing that, yeah.
Keying into that code.
Guy named Monty Judah. This is the person to whom I'm referring. But anyway, he was the engineer at the time. Anyway, they came up with one name out of all the global leaders, all the royalty in the world and so forth in this program of theirs that spit out as 666. And based on that, he went down to the libraries in Colorado Springs. This was, again, before I met him, actually, shortly before I met him. And he found on the front cover of one of the books on heraldry in a library there in the Springs, an unofficial version, not the official one, of this person whose name spit out as 666. And on that unofficial version, it looked like it had the imagery described in Revelation 13. Now, he showed me that stuff. And this was within a month of me praying there at the academy. And I wasn't looking for any of it. So I went back that day, this was a Saturday afternoon now, after that lunch, to the cadet library at the academy. And I thought, no, this is really interesting. And so I started to look through what they had was about a half a bookshelf or so of books on heraldry there in the library. And I started to thumb through them purely out of curiosity. And I found the one book in the world at that time. There was only one book on the planet that actually had the official coat of arms, the imagery in it. And that was a book called Boutell's Heraldry. And I documented that in the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. And the coat of arms that's on the front cover of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea came out of that book originally. But this coat of arms was first shown to the world in 1969 at the investiture of Prince Charles as Prince of Wales at Caernarvon Castle. And it was only up to the point of being in Boutell's heraldry on memorabilia from the investor, like the Order of Service, saucers and cups sold at the investor, that kind of thing. And then in this book, Boutell's Heraldry, which the cadet library happened to have, you know, out of all the books in heraldry in the world, on heraldry, the cadet library happened to have the one that I needed to see. So this was the same day that this engineer showed me these things. And this is why I say God showed me. It's not that I was looking for it. It's more like he led me by the nose.
Okay, great. Yeah, well, Prince Charles is an interesting character, isn't he? What is it that ties him then, in a nutshell, to the crest of his heraldry, or whatever you call it, to what it says in the Bible?
Well, there are multiple things. So, and I'll just go down the line of some of the evidence. One, of course, is the imagery, which is a creature with feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion. And Revelation 13, describing this imagery, says it rises out of the sea. In context, that would be off the coast, if you will, of Israel or somewhere out of the sea relative to Israel's coast. And that this red dragon, that's a red dragon of Revelation 12, which is identified also as a symbol of Satan, gives this beast that has the feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion, his power, throne, and great authority. So that's the imagery in Revelation 13, which in the same chapter goes on to tell us that this beast has a number. It's the number of the name of a man, quote unquote, that calculates to 666. That's what we get from Revelation 13, apart from it telling us that this person someday will have authority over the world's nations for a period of 3.5 years. Daniel chapter 7 in the Old Testament describes the same individual who will also have authority for the same 3.5 year period over the nations of the world, but with completely different imagery. In Daniel chapter 7, he's called the little horn of the eyes of a man. And in the context of Daniel historically, and when he was, you know, penning the book of Daniel, that would have been a unicorn with human eyes. So there's the imagery. Besides all that, there's the name calculation, and a lot of people historically have tried to contrive systems to do the calculation, invent systems, have tampered with names, in other words, altered the normal rendering or spelling
of names. You've got a major problem here, Tim, and that is that there's all sorts of different ways of coding names and letters into numbers.
But there's not, and this is where I'm going. You know, you would think that reading the English translation, for example, or for that matter, any translation of the book of Revelation, where you read the number 666 and it says calculate the name. If that's the only information we had, then you could easily argue, well, hey, what system are you supposed to use? Let's go create a system and see what we come up with. The problem is that all those translations come from the underlying Greek text. So the original text is in Greek. And in the Greek text of Revelation 13, 18, it actually identifies the system for the calculation. Not a lot of people realize this. Most numbers throughout the Bible, and we're talking both Old Testament and Hebrew, as well as New Testament and Greek, are written in the form of words. You know, like we would write SIX for the number 6 in English. There are a few exceptions. And in the New Testament, there are really only a couple of exceptions, both in the book of Revelation. One is the number 144 for the 144,000 that we read about, for example, in Revelation 14, the 144,000 sealed Israelites. The other exception is the number 666 in Revelation 13, verse 18. In the Greek text, those numbers are not written with words. Instead, they're specified with specific Greek letters that have numbers assigned to them. So 666 in the case of Revelation 13, 18 is written with one Greek letter for the number 600, a second letter for the number 60, and a third letter for the number 6. And because it's given that way rather than written in the form of words, it actually identifies the system we're supposed to use for the calculation. So it's not open to interpretation. And as it turns out, that system is derived from the ancient Hebrew numbering system. In ancient Hebrew, the original system, you know, Hebrew has 22 glyphs. Hieroglyphs is what they really are. We typically call them characters, but they're glyphs. And each of those glyphs has a number assigned, and it goes 1 through 9, then 10 through 90, so 10, 20 up through 90, and then 100 through 400. 100, 200, 300, 400. And it stops. It gets cut off at that point in the Hebrew because there are only 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. But the system was transferred sequentially, not phonetically, but sequentially, historically, to the ancient Greek language. And in the Greek version, after that transfer was accomplished, it was expanded to include 500 through 900, because Greek has more than 22 characters in its alphabet. So it was able to accommodate the rest of the system, if you will. And it's the Greek version that's used to specify 666 in Revelation. On that system, because it is sequential and not phonetic, we therefore, and there's a precedent for that, in other words, historically, we can take that same system and we can apply it to any language on earth sequentially and not phonetically.
So what's that Greek system called, Tim?
Well, it's called the Kabbalic numbering system today in Hebrew, even though it's not really Kabbalic. They call it that because it's typically used in Kabbalism, which is Jewish mysticism, but in reality, it predates Kabbalism, and it's the ancient biblical numbering system. There's no name for it. It's the biblical numbering system in Hebrew. And it was transferred historically, sequentially, to Greek. And I don't even know that there is a separate name for it either in Greek. But that's the system that's used in Revelation 13, 18. And we can transfer it sequentially to any language there is, including English.
Okay, yeah, I mean, anyone listening, is there anywhere we can easily look up where you've shown that this system, first of all, it is the biblical Greek system that was originally used in Revelation, which was written, I think, on the island of Patmos, and also that the calculation works out with Prince Charles's name, because people might wish to try other names in that system too.
Sure. Anybody can Google this and look up. They can look up the Antichrist nickname.
Not necessarily Google.
Well, the name calculation, what I'm telling you, the name calculation that is in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, where I actually show the system has been put online by others, and there are sample chapters also of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, the first edition online, where people can see the name calculation with the Hebrew, the English, and the Greek. And I've got more information on that, quite a bit more, by the way, in the second edition that's coming out. But what we've been discussing is available online. And in addition to that, they can go and look up an interlinear Greek-English New Testament, in this case, the Book of Revelation online. There are several examples online. They can look up Revelation chapter 13 in an interlinear Greek-English translation, and they can find the number 666 in the English translation in that interlinear version online, and see that the number is specified with three Greek letters. It's not written in the form of words.
So, I mean, we've got the number of a man. We've also got the symbolism in the crest of Prince Charles. Anything else in there that ties him to what it actually says in Revelation that you were originally talking about?
So there are multiple other things. One is the lineage. You know, one of the requirements to be the Messiah, or for this matter, a counterfeit Messiah for Israel, and I'm speaking of Israel that does not believe that Jesus is the Messiah, you know, or the God of Israel incarnate that rejects Yeshua as the Messiah. They're looking for a person to come along who can show a credible lineage with descent from Israel's ancient King David. Now, Israel's ancient genealogical records were destroyed when the Romans, you know, sacked Jerusalem in 70 AD roughly, and then later, early in the second century with the Bar Kokhba revolution, you know, leveled what was left. The genealogical records of the nation of Israel were destroyed and lost with that. So for anybody to come along today and attempt to show a lineage to King David is challenging, to say the least. But as it turns out, the British monarchy has a fairly granular genealogical record. Queen Elizabeth II's official lineage, in fact, was published decades ago. And I offered as a chart through Prophecy House the actual official lineage chart of Prince Charles' mother. And on that chart, they make explicit claim to descent from King David. The British monarchy makes explicit claim to sit upon the throne of David. They make explicit claim to be the royal house of Israel and the royal lineage of King David. And for whatever reason, that genealogical set of claims has been taken seriously enough in Israel to have been announced multiple times on national television that Prince Charles is a descendant of King David. And so far as I know, that announcement has not been made for any other human being on the planet.
Well, so he's also said, interestingly, Tim, he's also said he's a descendant of Count Dracula.
So, well, he is. He actually is.
But I mean, the big question there is, when did these claims begin? Because, of course, we know there was a very powerful Zionist movement in Britain under Queen Victoria. And it could be that those claims to be from the line of David originated as recently as then.
That's very possible. In fact, I'll be honest with you, I don't accept the claims. My point is only that Israel does. Somebody in Israel, in the rabbinic community, accepts those claims enough to have permitted such an announcement on national television more than once in Israel. I mean, that is stunning. Even if it's all made up, that's stunning. Now, the other thing is, the same lineage chart shows descent from what could be the Danites. And that very likely is a legitimate claim. And when I say the Danites, I'm talking about ancient Israel's tribe of Dan. And one reason that would be significant is that there's a prophecy concerning the tribe of Dan in Genesis. I think it's around 49 or 50, chapter 49 or 50, I forget. But a prophecy in which the red dragon, a serpent, a word in Hebrew that can be translated as red dragon, is associated with the tribe of Dan and also with causing its writer, who is named Yeshua in the Hebrew text, to fall backward. It's a messianic prophecy. In other words, this idea that a serpent, by the way, or a red dragon would strike the heels of a horse whose rider is named Yeshua so that the rider falls backward. That's a prophecy about the tribe of Dan. And ancient Israel sages looked at that prophecy and they concluded from it, and the early church concluded from it, that the Antichrist, the counterfeit Messiah, would descend from the tribe of Dan. And what's also interesting about that is it was the tribe of Dan that led ancient Israel into idolatry, resulting in the civil war that led to the schism between Judea and Israel, what became basically two nations. And then ultimately, Israel going into Assyrian captivity and later Judea into Babylonian captivity. And because of all of that, the tribe of Dan ended up being excluded, omitted completely from the 144,000 sealed Israelites in the book of Revelation, who are to be testifying, if you will, a kind of witness, but testifying concerning Yeshua, concerning Jesus to the nation of Israel during that 3.5-year period when the Antichrist will have sway over the nations of the world. So,
okay, so look, all that is to say, through these the various lineage proofs. Is there. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of the number of a man, the heraldry, the lineage, anything else?
Oh, yes. Like I said, there are several things. One of the most interesting things to me, and there are others, but one of the most interesting is the statue. You know, the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea was published in 1998. So it didn't have the statue that I'm about to talk about. But in the early 2000s, a statue was created to Prince Charles. And this was after the Rio Earth Summit. It was a statue commissioned by a Brazilian state government in Tocantins, which is on the outskirts of a Brazilian rainforest, to Prince Charles, an angelic figure. They actually called it in the press a winged god, quote unquote. But an angelic figure with Prince Charles' face standing atop a mass of human bodies, one of which is drinking a bottle of wine, dressed only in a loincloth, nothing else, and having his head. This is a bronze statue. They created it in two versions, the artist did. One was a miniature version, which was actually presented to Prince Charles in person and photographed by the BBC. And they did both a news report on it, where there's an audio report. You can probably still pull it up on the internet, as well as, you know, photographs and talked about it and mentioned that the full size version, which nobody's ever seen, it's crated away somewhere in a warehouse, presumably. But the full size version was to be about 15 feet roughly in height. And, you know, I think it's 4.5 meters, pardon me. So about 15 and a half feet. But anyway, one of the interesting things about the Antichrist is that an idol is to be erected to him. And scripture calls it both in the Gospels and the New Testament and the Olivet Discourses, where Jesus himself was speaking of future events. He called it the abomination that causes desolation. And it's a quote actually from Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, where it's translated typically as abomination that causes desolation. It's also translatable as the desolating abomination, but it is an idol that is to be erected in a newly constructed holy place, it appears, which doesn't exist right now, a newly constructed holy place on the Temple Mount in Israel in the future. So in other words, there's a statue that's to be erected at some point in the future, presumably in a holy of holies of a coming temple in Israel.
Doesn't the Bible talk about this abomination of desolation being animated in some way?
Yes, not so much animated as speaking. So we could think of that as voice synthesis today, potentially, but speaking. So it'll have, in some sense, a voice. And to put this in a little bit more context, Revelation 13, the same chapter that has the imagery and the name calculation, also speaks of a coming mark that is to be implemented to the Antichrist, so that people around the world will not be able to buy or sell unless they have that mark in some fashion imprinted on or embedded in their hand or forehead.
Okay, this is the mark of the beast.
Yes, and it's typically the right hand or the forehead, the way that it's written in, the way it's described in Scripture. Now, a lot of people today, Christians particularly, have engaged in some pretty, I will say, outlandish speculations on the nature of the mark. A lot of people say it's a biochip implant, and it could be, and I'll come back to why I say it's outlandish in a moment. You know, that it could be any number of things that people talk about. What they're not doing is looking carefully at the Greek text, and that's so important here to understand what it's talking about when it talks about a mark. In this case, the Greek word that's translated as mark is actually talking about a tattoo that has a picket-like fence appearance. So there's a very specific meaning to that Greek word, and it is a tattoo with a particular kind of an appearance. Why that's interesting is that the UPC and EAN barcodes that we already can't buy or sell without around the world look like a picket fence kind of pattern. And every one of those barcodes, UPC and EAN specifically, has a guard bar pattern. It's called the guard bar pattern. It's also called, alternately, the security bar pattern. And those are the two bars on either end of the code and then in the middle of the code, two bar patterns and then the bar pattern in the middle, which descend halfway roughly below the numbers that they're showing you, the digits that they are showing on these barcodes. So in other words, there's a set of bars on either end and then another set in the middle of each of these barcodes where they're not showing you the numbers that those bars represent. And those numbers are 666 in all cases. So in other words, the security bar pattern or the guard bar pattern of those barcodes is 666 in all cases throughout the world today. And that means that since the 1980s, when this was first implemented for buying and selling, the mark of the beast has been in use. It's just that they're not putting it physically on anyone's bodies yet by law. Although you can pull up photos, for example, in Japan of teenagers who think that it's fashionable to get barcode tattoos on the backs of their necks or on their foreheads or that kind of thing that are visible. So here's where I'm going with that. You asked me about this thing being animated, and I mentioned voice synthesis, right? In the let's talk about the United Kingdom for a moment. In the United Kingdom, you have Queen Elizabeth II's coat of arms, her heraldic achievement on many goods that are bought and sold, printed on the packaging, right? You go to a scanner to have the barcode on an item that you're purchasing scanned when you make the purchase. We do the same thing here in the United States. Many of those scanners have voice synthesis where they can literally turn up the volume and you can hear something read out to describe what it is that you're purchasing. So you make a purchase. When you do that, let's assume for a moment that you've got the barcode on your hand or forehead instead, that it's no longer just on the packaging. And let's assume that the barcode is in an ink that those scanners can read with their lasers, but that it's not visible to the naked eye, which technologically is possible and has been possible now for several years. So let's say you've got a tattoo on your hand or forehead that the scanners can see, but I can't see it with my eyes. Okay? You stretch forth your hand or you bow your forehead to that thing for them to scan it. And then let's say they've got the volume turned up and you hear something when you make your purchase, maybe what you're purchasing or your name, your ID, whatever it is. So Scripture says that this beast is going to be worshipped. And those who have the mark of the beast are going to worship him and worship it. So here's where this comes together. The technical definition in Greek for the word worship that's translated in English as worship is to bow the forehead, to stretch forth the hand, to bow the knee, to prostrate oneself before as if you were lying on the ground, or to kiss the hand, like, for example, when the Pope stretches forth his hand and somebody kisses the ring on his hand, to kiss the hand. Those are the five technical definitions of the word worship. So if you've got this mark on your hand or your forehead, and you're bowing your forehead, or you're stretching forth your hand, or let's backstep it for a moment. Let's say it's on a card, like a shopper card that you're using. Let's say it's a Costco card, like in the United States, or a Sam's Club card, or a value shopper card, you know, like for the grocery store chain where you're shopping, so that you get some discount for your purchase. Most of those cards have UPC or EAN barcodes on them. And so you've got that card in your hand, and you're stretching it forward for somebody to scan it so you can make a purchase, right? Well, you may not have in your mind that you're engaging in any form of worship whatsoever. You may have no spiritual mindedness, if you will, for the act that you're undertaking, which is a simple purchase. But by the technical definition, you are engaged in an act of worship, especially if it's associated ultimately with this Antichrist, this beast. So Prince Charles' coat of arms, his heraldic achievement, not the Queen's, but Prince Charles, has on it all the imagery of Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, as well as other symbols that are explicitly described in the Old and New Testaments for the Antichrist. And then additionally, of course, it's his title by which he's known globally, Charles, Prince of Wales, or Prince Charles of Wales, that calculates the 666. And by the way, Tony, this is in more than one language. So not only is it statistically impossible from a mathematical standpoint, statistically impossible for Charles, Prince of Wales, to calculate to 666 on the English version of the numbering system that we were talking about earlier, where the numbers are sequentially transferred to English. Although that's the reality, the title does calculate to exactly 666 in English. But as it turns out, it does so in more than one language. So in the Hebrew language, on the original numbering system where you don't actually have to transfer the numbers at all, the exact same title, the way that it's given in modern Israeli Hebrew, Charles, Prince of Wales, or Prince Charles of Wales, also calculates to exactly 666. Mathematically, that's impossible, but it's factual reality.
Well,
but here's where I'm going with this.
Have you any other specific?
I want to wrap this point up. So let's assume for a moment, in the future, your goods, it could even be here in the United States or somewhere else in the world, have Prince Charles' coat of arms on them, or let's say the register does, because now he's an authority over the nations, and I'll talk about how that will happen as well. But let's assume that his coat of arms is in widespread view at that point in history, in the not-too-distant future, when he's over the nations in a form of global governance. And people are now using the barcode in a more direct fashion. Let's say it's tied into their bank accounts. Maybe the number that it's encoding is an ID that ties to their bank accounts, for example, so that they can buy and sell. So they're stretching forth their hand to a register, and then they're hearing voice synthesis, right? All of that is this imagery, this beast speaking, if you will. Now, beyond that, you could have this statue that I was talking about to Prince Charles, which, by the way, is explicitly identified in the Hebrew text of Daniel 9:27, which I've not talked about. That's addressed in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. So not only is it a statue and idol, but it's got a very specific design for the Hebrew root words, the Hebrew text of Daniel 9:27. So you won't get it in the English. It's another thing like going to the Greek for the number 666 in Revelation. In this case, you have to go to the Hebrew for Daniel 9:27, which talks about the statue, the abomination. But anyway, that particular statue, not just any statue, is what's actually described in the Hebrew text. And I address that in detail in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea.
So look, we've got all these four things so far: the 666, the heraldry, the lineage, the statue. Any more?
Yep, peace process. You know, something happened this year that was a big deal that most people have missed, including in the church, and I'll come around to that. So I documented in the first edition of the Antichrist and Cup of Tea that all of these peace process efforts around Israel actually trace directly to Prince Charles. Most people don't realize this. So in the first edition of the book published in 1998, up to that point in history, I documented that what had been heard up to that point, which was the Oslo peace process, which was set up as Oslo 1, 2, and 3, and then the peace agreement with Jordan, which sat between Oslo 1 and 2, traced back to the Madrid Peace Conference and Madrid Peace Talks in Spain shortly before that. So that's where the Oslo process came from. It derived from the what was happening in Madrid, Spain prior to that. And the Madrid Peace Talks themselves traced back to Israel's Shimon Peres, who is now deceased, and Jordan's King Hussein at meetings that they had in London in 1987 under the auspices of a Lord Victor Mishkan, who was a lawyer doing work for the British monarchy, among others, including for Prince Charles. So at Prince Charles' behest, Lord Victor Mishkan arranged the meetings between Jordan's King Hussein, who's now deceased. His son is now King of Jordan. But Jordan's King Hussein and then Israel's Shimon Peres. Now, Shimon Peres at the time was the second, if you will, under Yitzhak Shamir, who was the premier in Israel. Shamir was not too happy about the whole thing and shelved it. Subsequently, after the Madrid peace talks, you know, which this London Agreement of 1987, and that's what it's actually called, the London Agreement of 1987, and Shimon Peres talked about that in his book called The New Middle East. That's the title of Peres's book. But anyway, after the Madrid peace talks, when Yitzhak Rabin became prime minister of Israel, and he was assassinated, you'll recall, in the mid-1990s, but Rabin allowed Peres to revive the London Agreement of 1987, and that in turn directly led to the Oslo peace talks. Now, those led to Oslo 1, 2, and 3 was supposed to happen, but never did. So Oslo 1 and 2 and 3 were divided into three agreements, two phases, if you will. Those phases were, first of all, to be security talks, and secondly, peace talks. Now, Oslo 1, and you recall there was this big signing deal on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton and, at that time, Peres and Rabin and Arafat. Oslo 1 was a declaration of principles that everybody signed and was actually an agreement on principles to negotiate a treaty. It was not itself a treaty. Oslo 2, on the other hand, was an actual treaty. And between Oslo 1 and 2, the peace treaty with Jordan occurred. Oslo 3 was supposed to be the peace treaty, which never happened. Rabin was assassinated, and in lieu of Oslo 3, something called the Quartet and the Roadmap stepped into the picture, if you will. Now, up to that point, everything was directly traceable to Prince Charles. The Quartet was structured as the United States, the European Union, Russia, and then the United Nations, the UN, as the fourth member. And because the UN was in there, it was basically all the nations of the world. The Quartet was headed for a long time by Tony Blair. And you're probably familiar with that.
Well, yeah, Tony Blair was a Middle East peace envoy. I think many people in Britain raised their eyebrows when that, especially after he'd started an illegal war there.
Yes. Well, Tony Blair still reported to Prince Charles, you know, as his you know, prince in waiting, if you will, you know, under the sovereign. He still reported to Prince Charles all that time. And now it's another British citizen who's taken over the Quartet for Tony Blair. But again, under Prince Charles. So behind the scenes, this whole effort that the whole world talks about you know, where they get all up in arms over so-called settlements and Israel wanting to construct this or that, you know, in Eastern Jerusalem, or wanting to have sovereignty over Eastern Jerusalem. And of course, you know, Israel annexed the old city of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, historically after the 1967 Six-Day War. But all that is to say, the whole thing has sat under Prince Charles all this time. And up until this year, Prince Charles and other members, until 2018, in this case, other members of the royal household of the UK, which, of course, you know, is the royal household over the nation that produced the Balfour Declaration and so forth, right? And had a big hand in dividing up the territory there in the Middle East after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, etc., to produce all those nations over there in the Middle East now, including Israel. So the British monarchy refused to officially have any member of the monarchy visit Israel, you know, after its founding in 1948. It was only William, I think it was in 2018, who made the first official visit. And then after that, Prince Charles earlier this year. And what Prince Charles did earlier this year was a very big deal. So Prince Charles had been there a couple of times previously, a few times actually, in an unofficial capacity, primarily to visit, for example, his grandmother's grave on the Mount of Olives, because she's been honored in Israel. And then William went in an official capacity in 2018, Prince Charles' son. And then this year, Prince Charles himself went for the first time. And what he did is he went for the World Holocaust Forum event as a speaker. So they, Israel, arranged to have the Allies and the Axis powers, you know, the successors of those, speak at the WHF event this year. And so you had Germany's president speak, you had France's president speak, you had Vice President Pence for the United States speak, you had Israel's president and Prime Minister, so Netanyahu and Rivlin, both speak. You had Russia's president, Putin, speak. And then instead of having the Prime Minister of the UK speak, you had Prince Charles speak. He was the other one. Of all of the speakers at the event, the two best speeches by far, and I listened to them all in full, were given by Russia's Putin, curiously enough, and Prince Charles. Prince Charles gave a stunning speech. It was fantastic. And it endeared him big time, if you will, to Israel's populace. I mean, it was a superb speech. But curiously, very curiously, Prince Charles skipped the group photos of the other world leaders. There was a photo before the speeches were given and another group photo after the speeches were given. Prince Charles was the only speaker to skip the photos in both cases. And immediately following his speech, he went to meet with Orthodox Christians, Muslims, at, in this case, an Orthodox church, and then a Muslim synagogue, and then also with Abbas for the Palestinians, specifically to push, in this case with Abbas, the division of Jerusalem and to encourage them in their effort to pursue East Jerusalem as their capital, basically stabbing Israel in the back and contravening, if you will, even what the Trump administration has been trying to do with their peace process initiative under Jared Kushner, who, by the way, and you might know this also, has a property, people have brought this up under the topic of the Antichrist, a property at an address that is 666, which is just funny in a sense. But Kushner has been the primary protagonist, along with other direct people in the Trump administration, for the I'll call it the fake or the false peace process with Israel. At any rate, Prince Charles is not in complete agreement, if you will, with what the Trump administration has pursued. He wants to see the land divided. He wants to see Jerusalem divided. He wants to see the Palestinians have their own state with half of Jerusalem, you know, as it were, the old city that has the Temple Mount area as their capital. So in a very real sense, he betrayed Israel with that, while at the same time, immediately before that, giving a superb speech against anti-Semitism and against the Holocaust and the events around it, etc. So that happened this year. And to me, that is a big red flag that we're getting close to what Christians call the tribulation period or the tribulation week, the latter half of which, the final 3.5 years of which, is called the Great Tribulation, the period in which the Antichrist has his reign.
Okay, well, why don't you take us through this idea of Prince Charles becoming something of a figure on the world stage? Because we've got some interesting indications that that might be true. Firstly, that his association with Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, who had a partnership agreement last September with the United Nations, which looks to me, slightly cynically maybe, is more like a hostile takeover of the United Nations, because the UN's been running out of money. The World Economic Forum, Davos in Switzerland, is awash with money. And so this partnership agreement does look as if the World Economic Forum are going to start to be calling the shots in this global regulator set up to keep the peace after World War II. So there's that side, and there's various other things as well. But particularly the other aspect of Prince Charles being somehow on the world stage. We have next April, the Queen turns 95 years old, and there are various rumours, but some announcements that she may actually retire and hand over to the next in line as a Prince Regent. Now, that could be William, it could be Charles. So what do you think?
Now, the World Economic Forum, they had the Great Reset, quote unquote, that everybody's been talking about in the news. And of course, Prince Charles was a speaker there and directly refer to the quote-unquote Great Reset, which is in a sense just a new euphemism for the New World Order. They're talking about the same thing. And when we talk about COVID, they've talked about COVID in multiple venues and multiple contexts being something that, surprisingly to some and I think not to others, has facilitated their Great Reset, if you will, efforts. Now, setting that aside for a moment, and I'll come back to that, the history of the United Nations itself as an organization is one of it coming out of the League of Nations. Now, the League of Nations, you know, pre-World War II, actually traces its origin not just to the victors of World War I, but to the British monarchy, and specifically the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the RIIA, or Chatham House in London. Prince Charles heads the RIIA, or Chatham House in London, and has for quite some time now. Additionally, so in other words, the UN traces its history to that. You would think just on its surface that that might give him some leverage, perhaps, in the United Nations. So to make that real, but there are multiple examples of this in even the first edition of the Antichrist and Decapitate. There's more in the upcoming edition. But the United Nations has what it calls a global security lecture series, where every year now, pretty much, they've had world leaders come in and deliver lectures on global security. The very first lecture in that series ever was given by Prince Charles at the UN. Who's heard of that? And there are many initiatives like that that trace directly to Prince Charles in and outside of the United Nations, including the big push for public-private partnerships with the UN. Much of what had been called the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum in the past, PWBLF, was structured around public-private partnerships. So a lot of the things we see in the world today where national governments public, partner, if you will, with industry in an almost fascist and often overtly fascist sense, traces to initiatives under the PWBLF and Prince Charles. There are many things like this that the public has not generally heard, where Prince Charles has prominence globally among globalists. When we talk about the environmental movement, for example, the modern environmental movement traces to the British monarchy. So it goes back to the Flora and Fauna Protection Society, if I remember right, of the 1800s, out of the British monarchy, which, you know, later led to things like the World Resources Institute and the World Wildlife Fund, which Prince Philip headed for quite a while, and then was headed by Prince Charles. The Rio Earth Summit of the early 1990s, I mentioned the statue to Prince Charles. The Rio Earth Summit took place prior to the publication of the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cupidity, so I documented that in the first edition. At that time, when it took place, most of the world had heard of Al Gore, you know, as prominent, you know, besides perhaps Prince Philip, as prominent in the global arena for environmentalism, you know, and environmental initiatives and so on. But in reality, Prince Charles was more prominent than any of them. And in fact, the key players of the Rio Earth Summit credited Prince Charles, not Al Gore. They credited Prince Charles. Al Gore also explicitly credited Prince Charles for the success of the Rio Earth Summit following the summit itself, because it was Prince Charles who organized meetings aboard the Royal Yacht Britannia of the key participants at the Rio Earth Summit, to include Al Gore, Brazil's president, a variety of other people. And because of what Prince Charles did in chairing those meetings and guiding them, those leaders subsequently credited him for the success of the summit. And that directly led to the statue that was commissioned by the state government of Tocantins in Brazil to Prince Charles. And I didn't mention this earlier, but there's an inscription on the base of that statue, Tony, and people can see this in the reporting, both the BBC audio report that was done where they filmed the statue and showed it in photos, and also the printed news articles on the statue from the early 2000s. There's an inscription at the base of that statue, and it is, quote-unquote, Savior of the World, written in British spelling, S-A-V-I-O-U-R. They were calling Prince Charles specifically the Savior of the World with that statue. And I mentioned it has his face, right, and angelic wings. They were doing that in the context of viewing him as the environmental Savior of the World, okay? So the Rio Earth Summit, which the United States sort of signed on to, sort of didn't, led to the Kyoto Protocol years later in Japan. You would have heard of that, right? That predated the Copenhagen talks in Denmark and predated the 2015 Paris Climate Talks or Paris Climate Conference. So I'll come back to those. But the Kyoto Protocol is something that the United States did not sign, but most of the rest of the world did. And the rest of the world was trying to get the United States on board with it for several years. And that came directly out of the Rio Earth talks and summit. So again, Prince Charles credited for that. Who hears about that publicly today? Almost no one. The Denmark talks, the Copenhagen talks, which took place when the Obama administration was active in the United States a few years ago, were not a success. There was not enough agreement to really lead to anything at those talks. The next round of serious talks from that took place in 2015. And these were called the Paris Climate Talks, Paris Climate Conference. It was hosted by France's president, Holland. I think that's right. But hosted by France's president. And you would think that since France's president was hosting the talks and they were taking place in Paris, that he would have been the one to open the talks and probably give the first speech and introduce everybody, etc. And if not him, then maybe somebody like Obama would have done it, right? Or Al Gore, perhaps even. That's what you would think, you know, given the level of knowledge the public has and the things that the public media puts out there. That would be the normal guess of a person on the street, I would think. But in actuality, it was Prince Charles. Prince Charles personally opened the event. He gave the first speech at the event. And then at the group photo for the event, he was at the very center of all the world leaders in the position of prominence over everybody else globally. At that event, you had the largest gathering of global leadership in the history of the entire world in one place at one time. 150 plus world leaders, in other words, heads of nations. 190 plus world leaders overall, but 150 plus heads of state. And none of them opened the event. Prince Charles opened the event. He's not even a head of state, right? Why? We have to ask the question, why? And it's because all of those people, global leadership, they know behind the scenes just how prominent Prince Charles actually is. They know that this whole global thing, all this global talk of anthropogenic, you know, human-caused global warming kind of thing, this whole thing is sitting beneath Prince Charles. And at that conference, Prince Charles stated that they needed to transfer roughly $9 trillion with a T, not billion, but trillion dollars in taxes from the world's nations to finance dealing with global warming in the near future. Now, when you think about this, and I break this down, by the way, in the second edition of the Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, $9 trillion is enough money to put every human being whom they claim is in danger at any point in the future of being affected by so-called global warming and rising seas and this kind of thing, in very nice homes, brand new, very nice homes everywhere on the planet. That's how much $9 trillion is. It's like it's almost $200,000 per person, roughly. You know, of those they're claiming to be potentially threatened or affected by global warming in the future. So it's an enormous sum of money. But what it really is a scam to enable a form of taxation through global warming, if you will, to facilitate global governance in the future. And it's all under Prince Charles. So, you know, that's an example of his prominence, you know, apart from what happened in Israel earlier this year. In this case, that's related to the climate stuff. But there are many other examples. And so I address this in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. And these are things that people would look at and say, gee, that's true. Why didn't I hear about that? Or why hasn't anybody put that together as a list of things that he's been front and center for? You know, so for example, in the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, is that, you know, there are lots of other examples. You'll recall that the UK turned over Hong Kong to communist China in the 1990s, right? Still there?
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes, that definitely did happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So who did that? Who did that for the United Kingdom?
Well, what they say here is a chap called Chris Patton, who then went on to become chairman of the BBC.
No, Prince Charles. Prince Charles personally handed over Hong Kong. And in fact, they filmed him doing it. So it was Prince Charles for the UK who did that. And when you go back to world events, his investiture in July of 1969 was the most widely viewed event in the history of the world at the time. An estimated television audience of 500 million plus. The only event to that point in history to rival it was the Apollo 11 moon landing in the same month. Then after that, his wedding to Princess Diana. Estimated television audience of 1 billion plus, up to 1.5 billion, 1.75 billion people, depending on what estimate you read, somewhere between 1.25 billion, 1.75 billion estimate. Then, you know, of television audience. Then after that, his handover of Hong Kong to communist China, the new most widely viewed event in the history of the world up to that point. And then after that, we get into other things like what I've been talking about so far in the interview. So how do you explain that about one human being who has the imagery, the name calculation, the lineage, the statue? And again, not just any statue. You know, I mentioned the Hebrew root words in Daniel 9:27. I show in the second edition of the Antichrist in a Cup of Tea that the statue is associated with somebody whose name means strong man. You know, it has to do with the idea of imposition or enforcement for the treaty that's addressed in the same verse of Daniel chapter 9. This treaty, in other words, this false peace treaty that the Antichrist is involved with, and Israel is involved with, this whole thing around the false peace process that relates to this statue. And all of that is in this one verse in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. The Hebrew root words describing that statue talk about it having overspreading wings, dressed only in a loincloth, if you can believe that. It's bizarre. But the root words actually indicate that the statue is dressed in a loincloth. And it's associated with someone whose name means strong man in the Hebrew text. And it's associated with someone who is a prince, and not just any prince. There are multiple words for prince in Hebrew. This particular word for prince means heir apparent to a throne. So in other words, it's a prince who's in line to be on a throne, who's not actually on a throne, and who's not in line to be on a throne, but who is in line to be on a throne. So the name Charles in English means strong man. That's what it actually means. Not everybody knows that, but that's the meaning of the word Charles.
What does this actually mean when it comes to interpreting the events of Revelation? I think maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but it would be certainly interesting to hear what you think, you know, whoever the Antichrist turns out to be, how that is likely to look. You already talked about 3.5 years, but can you tell us, you know, in just like 5 minutes or something? I know it's a short time, but how you think Revelation is speaking to us today about, it's a bit like a crystal ball telling us what's going to happen. And of course, you know, with a loving God would do that. You know, they wouldn't just leave his people to be confused, upset, he would make sure that the purpose was shown to them. What do you think is going to unfold as these events in Revelation take place here on earth?
Okay, so in the Antichrist in the Cup of Tea, the first edition, pages 394 to 96, I actually gave a list of events that would precede the start of the Great Tribulation. And it's at the Great Tribulation that the Antichrist actually comes to power. So the Great Tribulation is that 3.5 year period in which he has his global authority. There are a series of events scripturally that are to precede that. The Great Tribulation itself begins roughly in the 4th year of a 7 year period that Christians call the Tribulation period or the Tribulation week. It's a period outlined also in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. It's a 7 year period. Now, Revelation is structured around 7 seals. It's roughly a seal per year. The 4th seal is where we get into the 4th horseman, and there are 3 horsemen, or horsemen per seal for the first 3 seals, where the first one is a white horse, then the second one is a fiery red horse, the third one is it's not really black. It's translated as black, but it's not really an accurate translation. It's more like a dark blue, black, grayish, red-hued kind of a horse, which is very strange sounding, but it's actually the coloration of that horse. It's called Blucifer outside of Denver International Airport. People can look that up. BLU, just like Lucifer, but with B in front of it, Blucifer. That horse with the fiery red eyes, when it's lit up at night, it's that coloration. And then the 4th horseman, which is typically translated as gray or ashen, is actually it's pale green gray is what the Greek text means. And it's actually the color of rotting flesh. And as it turns out, the unicorn on Prince Charles' coat of arms has that exact coloration. And when you scan it on a color scanner and you look at it digitized, for example, on a display, not printed, because CMYK, when you print it like on the cover of a book, can't actually reproduce all those colors. But on a display, like an RGB display, you can see them. And on an RGB display, you can see that that unicorn has a greenish hue to it. So it's not just gray. It's pale green gray. So the point is, all the horses have specific functions that lead up to the Great Tribulation, specific prophetic events that occur. The second horseman is this fiery red horse. Now, my book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War, Behold a Red Horse, I'm showing that the fiery red horse and its rider and the sword spoken of in the second seal, which summarizes the second year roughly of that seven-year period. So sometime before the Great Tribulation begins, sometime before World War III, sometime before the global government is constituted, that the events under that second seal pertain to North Korea, Iran, the oil industry, specifically mobile oil, and ExxonMobil, which is an interesting tie-in with Rex Tillerson, who had been the Secretary of State under Trump for a while. And then Saudi Arabia and Iran generally, where they use the sword as a symbol for Islam. You know, Iran has the sword on its flag. The fiery red horse is actually the national symbol of North Korea, kind of like the United States, for example, has the eagle on the dollar bill. I show in this book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War, that that is the national symbol of North Korea. They have it on their currency. It overlooks downtown Pyongyang. The United States had the Red Horse Brigades, which is an acronym. It was an engineering set of brigades facing off against North Korea in the Korean War, called the Red Horse Brigades because that's the national symbol of North Korea, etc. So the other horsemen, I believe I've identified. Some of that information is in the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. The rest in my other upcoming books. But all this is to say there are a series of events to take place. What I address specifically in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea is that we will see Israel attacked. And also, by the way, I address this in Israel, quote unquote, peace in the coming world war, that multi-volume series that's coming out. But we'll see Israel attacked successfully, where Jerusalem is encircled by Israel's enemies. And half of the city, only half, meaning the half that Israel captured in the 67 war, will be taken by force from Israel, and that will include the Temple Mount area. And when that transpires, at the same time that that is transpiring, the abomination that causes desolation will be erected. And that means that by that point in history, some portion of a new temple will have to have been constructed and be sitting on the Temple Mount so that the statue can be put there, the large full-size version of it. So the statue will be erected, and then also the Antichrist will receive a mortal wound so that he recovers from it in a way that the world literally begins to worship him, and he'll be possessed by Satan at that point, just as Judas Iscariot was possessed by the devil before he went to betray Christ so that he'd be crucified. In this case, the Antichrist will be possessed right before he goes to betray Israel as a nation, if you will, with half of Jerusalem taken captive in war.
So well, look, I hesitate to interrupt you, Tim, but this idea of constructing a temple in Jerusalem, does rather rankle with the Muslims, because it is feasible that the ancient Al-Aqsa Mosque may have to be demolished in order to construct that temple. Now, that would seem to be a potential powder keg for a war anyway.
Well, that's true. And there is a long-running debate, decades long, in Israel and among archaeologists as to whether or not that mosque is actually sitting where the temple was or sitting adjacent to where the temple was. And I've done my own research on this. I tend to agree with those who say that the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, was an outer wall of the temple compound historically. In other words, that where Israel thinks the temple sat is correct. that they've correctly identified the actual location. So it may be that it requires some sort of an agreement between Israel and her adversaries to construct something next to or adjacent to the mosque. It's quite clear that Israel's government to this point has been very cowardly and fearful of rankling the surrounding Muslim nations, you know, which number, you know, hundreds of millions of people. If you add up, you know, if you include Indonesia, it's a ton of people. But even just the surrounding nations, several tens of millions of people versus Israel's very small Jewish populace. So, yes, Israel has nuclear weapons, perhaps. They don't admit
they
to do. It. But
yes, they do.
And could do a lot of damage. But what can you do when they keep coming like ants, right, if you rile them enough? So in this case, Israel's been very fearful to construct anything, even for that matter, to allow open worship or prayers of, you know, Jewish or Christian people in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so it's very likely that it will require either a new Israeli government that is very so-called right-wing and just says, you know, to whatever, you know, with the surrounding Muslim nations, we're going to trust God to defend us if they attack us. And by the way, they won't want to be turned into, you know, radioactive whatever if they do. You know, some right-wing government to just throw caution to the wind and proceed with plans that have been underway now for decades to be able to construct a new temple compound, probably adjacent to the mosque. But, you know, there could be an earthquake that wipes out the mosque. Any number of things could happen. It could be wiped out in some intervening war. We just don't know. Or they could get some political agreement to construct something on the basis of the whole, you know, false peace process, if there is some other agreement to be made. I mean,
surely there is another way, and that is that there is some kind of sensible understanding between Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Same building, could the same building not be used as on Fridays as a mosque, on Saturdays as a synagogue, and on Sundays as a church?
Well, I would say it's the Orthodox and, to a lesser extent, the ultra-Orthodox, but primarily the Orthodox in Israel who wish to build a temple, who actually care about a temple much more so than the ultra-Orthodox, many of whom would agree with Iranian leaders, you know, that Zionism shouldn't exist, that Israel as a nation shouldn't be there in the land today because the Messiah hasn't come yet, this kind of thing. Much more so than, in other words, Reform, conservative, or even ultra-Orthodox, so, or for that matter, secular Jews who really don't care. They just want to live in peace. So for that reason, I would say, given that it is the Orthodox community that has the biggest stake in the construction of a new temple, it's unlikely to me that they would agree to what they would clearly view as apostasy, to a compromise, to worship in a mosque under any circumstance. The rest of Israel probably would agree to it. So we'll have to see how that works out. That being said, you know, there are many Christians also who think that Israel will sign some sort of a treaty under the auspices of the Antichrist, this Prince of Roman lineage per Daniel 9:27, this treaty that's to be imposed or enforced. I submit that the scripture does not require Israel to sign anything. It also does not require Israel's enemies, specifically in this case, the so-called Palestinians who are claiming East Jerusalem, etc., to sign
anything. Hang on, Tim. It's not just them, is it? This is the UN as well. I mean, historically, this the territory has been pinched by the Israelis at like the Golan Heights. Much of it is actually not officially theirs. They've just stolen it. And the idea really is to say, oh, we need a buffer zone against the Arabs. But then you have another buffer zone, and every one of those buffer zones contains human beings who are living, who are then being occupied by a foreign power.
Well, I'd say whenever we use the word steal, we have to talk about historical context. And when we talk about historical context, we also have to talk about time period. So if we talk time periods, ancient Israel, meaning the time period of David and Solomon and before them, after the exodus from Egypt, had that territory. Before there was an entity called the Palestinians, before Islam existed as a religion, before Christianity existed, etc., Israel had the territory. God had given it to Israel. And God had delineated in the Old Testament certain borders for the land that he had promised to give to Israel, conditioned on Israel being faithful to him.
But it creates a very dangerous precedent, surely, because you've now got Palestinians saying, actually, we want our land back, the land that the Israeli settlers have illegally taken from us.
Well, sure, I'll come to that. So, you know, historically, there was never a time in history, ever, when Israel had all of the land that God promised to Israel. And that land would be bordered by the Nile River, by the Euphrates River, and then by the seas. So if you were to take that chunk of land today, it would be huge. There'd be no Saudi Arabia, no Qatar, no Oman, no UAE, no Lebanon, no Jordan. A quarter of Egypt would be gone. A big chunk of Iraq would be gone. And some other smaller nations would all be, Kuwait would be gone. Some other smaller nations would all be part of that territory that would then be called Israel in the biblically defined promised land. So there's that. But then historically, Israel was never faithful to God. Israel was constantly unfaithful to one degree or another. The only time in history when Israel had a significant chunk of that territory was under David and Solomon. And Solomon, in half of his reign, was a type of Christ. He was faithful to God in half of his reign. In the other half of his reign, he became a type of the Antichrist, even up to the number 666 being associated with him. And he became very unfaithful to God and participating in the worship of all the false gods of the nations, the surrounding nations.
And he built a temple.
But anyway, all of that, and that was when he was being faithful to God, mostly that he did that initially. But the point is, Israel ultimately was so unfaithful to God that Israel participated in the Roman crucifixion of Christ, you know, demanding the crucifixion, unbelieving Israel, right? So after that, around that time of Christ's coming, and then after that on into the early first century, roughly one-third, one in three Israelites believed that Yeshua was the Messiah and the God of Israel incarnate. The other two-thirds rejected that. And the rejecting portion became so rebellious toward the Roman Empire, which God had allowed still to control the territory of the nation up to that point, the portion of the territory that Israel actually controlled, which was called Judea, became so rebellious that Rome had just had enough, came in and, you know, sacked the temple roughly AD 70 under Titus and the Roman legions, and Israel's surrounding enemies enlisted into the Roman armies that participated in that destruction. Terrible destruction, terrible death in Israel, mass murder of Israelites. But again, practically all of them were non-believers because Christ had warned believing Israelites to flee from Judea and Jerusalem to the mountains in the wilderness when they would see Jerusalem encircled. Now, his warnings had to do with what for us are still future events. But back there in the second century, they said, well, now, wait a minute, this seems to apply now. And they got out of Dodge, so to speak, in this case, out of Jerusalem, out of Judea. And so many of those whom the Romans killed were not believers. They were unbelieving Israelites. And then the rest got scattered in the early second century under the Bar Kokhba revolution. Bar Kokhba was set up as a false messiah, an antichrist figure by unbelieving Israel. Got scattered to the rest of the nations and throughout the Roman Empire and ultimately scattered around the world. And so Israel ended and as a nation, as a national entity with a geographic territory. And the Romans renamed the land Palestine. That's where the name came from originally. They said there's not going to be an Israel anymore. Now it's Palestine. And so when you get to the 4th century AD and the Roman Catholic Church is constituted under Constantine, and they took all these pagans throughout the Roman Empire, and now they said, okay, now you're Christians. You can keep your idols. We'll call this one Mary, and you can call Semiramis and Isis Mary, and you know, Horus and Tammuz, you can call them baby Jesus, and you can keep your idols to the woman and her child. Just we'll rename them what the Zodiac intended them to originally be. And we'll call, you know, the winter solstice, the winter celebration, Christmas, and yada yada. So they Christianized all this stuff. They turned the feast of Astarte, or to the goddess Astarte, or Isis, this or whatever, into Easter.
Let's cut to the chase, and finally, so, to link
so
up,
today,
if you can, Prince Charles, right, with right, what's going to be happening, you know, in the end times, finally. I mean, where is it all going to end up, and who's going to win or lose?
Okay, you have two children in the Promised Land now. You recall two children were brought before Solomon, right? Or one child, I should say, two mothers. They each had a child. One mother rolled over on her child in the night. He suffocated. He died. She stole the other woman's child, claimed it for her own. They ended up going before Solomon, who offered to cut the child in two, right? And give half to each of the two women. Now, the woman whose child it wasn't was pleased with the arrangement. She said, okay. The other woman was, you know, beside herself over it and said, no, you know, give the child to this woman who's stolen from me. I'm paraphrasing, okay? So the real mother didn't want to see her child cut in two. The false mother was pleased to see it happen in order to spite the real mother because her child had lived, all right? That's the situation today. The so-called Palestinians are basically Arabs from surrounding territories who initially under the Ottoman Empire, but more so in the early 19th century and later, and some of them late in the 20th or in the 20th century, and then some of them late in the 19th century, you know, moved in to those lands, cultivated fields, etc. And then around the time of the Balfour Declaration and afterwards became called this Palestinian entity, which they weren't before. Jordan was supposed to have been, you know, around the time of the Balfour Declaration and afterwards, Jordan was supposed to have been the so-called Palestinian
state. But don't
state.
The Israeli state have to show a good example of a good moral behavior in order to actually claim that land?
No. What Israel does have to do is turn back to God faithfully. And until Israel does turn back to her God, and by that I mean become Christian, en masse, overnight. Until that occurs, the nation will continue to be attacked by her surrounding enemies, and it will become so severe. In other words, God will turn Israel over to her enemies, just as he did historically when we had the Assyrian captivity and then the Babylonian captivity and then what Rome did, to the point where half of Jerusalem is taken captive in war. Those who are taken captive are carried away as far as Babylon in Iraq, and you know, Saddam Hussein had been rebuilding the capital of Babylon in Iraq.
So, yeah, but do you see the Israelis doing that? And obviously, you know, if you're going to change over to being a Christian nation, then it's going to also mean a change of heart. It's going to mean a change of morality.
It won't happen until the majority of Israel sees Christ return in person at his second advent. So what will happen is with this captivity, those who remain in Judea, and God has commanded Christians, believers, in other words, specifically, and I'm talking Jew and Gentile alike. So Jew would be somebody like me, you know, a Levite who happens to believe that Yeshua, Jesus, is the Messiah and the God of Israel incarnate, just like every Christian there is. So someone like me, and then Gentiles, non-Israelite Christians. He's commanded those who believe to get out of Judea, which is, by the way, where most of modern Israel's population is. In the modern nation of Israel, the vast majority of the Israelite population from all of the tribes who are there are residing in the territory that historically was called Judea, including Jerusalem. And so Christ has commanded in the Olivet Discourses those who do serve him, who believe in him, to leave Jerusalem, to leave Judea, to flee to the mountains in the wilderness, to get out of Dodge, if you will, when we see A, the abomination that causes desolation erected in this holy place where it's not supposed to be, and B, Jerusalem surrounded by the militaries of the nations. And Christ justified his command to his disciples by saying, "For there will be great tribulation upon this people." When he says this people, he's talking about those who are in Judea, geographically speaking. So it's geographically constrained to those who are in the area of Judea, which is where modern Israel is for the most part. So great tribulation is going to come upon them. And according to Ezekiel chapters 5 and 6 and Zechariah chapters 12 through 14, and I address this in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, and also in my upcoming Messiah History and the Tribulation Period multi-volume series, according to those prophecies, two-thirds of Israel who remain there in the land in Judea are going to die. So we're talking about, Tony, the equivalent of a new Holocaust, literally, where millions of Israelites are going to die in a short period of time, within a period of under 3.5 years. And that is only years from now that that is going to begin. And it'll be under the period in which the Antichrist has his global rule. Now, out of that period and during that period, you will have a couple of things. One will be two witnesses, two prophets of God, who will prophesy to the nation of Israel and will be in Israel during that time, the two people who are protected supernaturally by God from the plagues that are occurring and the judgments that are occurring. One of them will be the actual Elijah of the Old Testament sent back to earth, in other words, brought from the past to the future by God to testify to Israel, the actual prophet Elijah. So not like John, who was a type of Elijah in the crucifixion week and in Christ's first advent, the actual Elijah of history, in other words. The other prophet, we don't know who that is, if it's going to be somebody who was born in our generation, if it's going to be Moses, or if it's going to be Enoch, a pre-flood prophet, pre-Noah's flood prophet, who, like Elijah, was taken by God directly to heaven, who never died. We don't know who it is. But those two witnesses are going to testify to Israel, and they're simultaneously going to torture the nations of the world that are afflicting Israel during that 3.5 year period in which two-thirds of those who are in Judea die. And then with that, additionally, you'll have at some point, not immediately, but at some point, 144,000 sealed Israelites. The tribe of Dan is completely excluded from among them. So the tribe of Joseph gets 24,000. Of the 144,000, 12,000 from Manasseh, 12,000 from Ephraim, the two half-tribes of Joseph, comprising that 144,000 who will be witnesses to the nation of Israel, unbelieving Israel, during that period, telling Israel that Jesus, Yeshua, really is the Messiah of Israel, really is the God of Israel, and that he's coming back to save the nation as soon as the nation cries out to him and acknowledges him for who he is, the God of Israel incarnate. So at the end of that 3.5 year period, right before the nations gather for the Battle of Armageddon, and as Christ returns looking like a bright burning star toward the earth, the surviving third of Israel up to that point, the remainder of Israel, will en masse recognize that they'll finally recognize that the two witnesses have been telling them the truth. The church all this time has been telling them the truth, and their own rabbis have been lying through their teeth all these centuries. When they say that Jesus, Yeshua, isn't the Messiah or the God of Israel, they've been completely misled by their religious leadership. They will finally realize that Jesus, Yeshua, really is the God and Messiah of Israel. And as soon as that happens, he will begin to defend the nation of Israel. And when the nations gather for the Battle of Armageddon under the Antichrist to try to prevent what then is about to occur, meaning where the God of Israel is going to go forward and annihilate Israel's enemies globally, totally wipe them out, including all their militaries.
Okay, so you seem to be hinting that maybe Prince Charles is heading for a global role rather than taking over as king here in England. He may be passing it on to William.
Well, it's his title. And I wrote this, by the way, in the first edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. So this is not new. I have maintained all this time that he will not be king of England. I have maintained even in the first edition of the book published in 1998 that he might become king of Europe instead. And it was after his investiture in July of 1969 that he publicly made known, publicly, that he wanted to be king of Europe, not king of England. He stated that publicly. And so I've maintained that he could become potentially king of Europe because genealogically the British monarchy is the royal house, not only of England and then Germany, because, you know, they had been Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. So not only of England and Germany, you know, having renamed it to House of Windsor, but also France and Greece, etc. So they are the monarchy, if you will, of Europe today. If the European Union wanted to choose, if that ever happened, its own monarchy, there's no question that it would be the British monarchy. But regardless, I've maintained that Prince Charles will remain either Prince of Wales, because it's his title, Charles, Prince of Wales, that calculates the 666 on that biblical numbering system, through the point where he attains his global role. In other words, gains control over that future global government, or that if he becomes King of England, he'll achieve or acquire some new title that likewise calculates to 666. But there's another component.
Interesting. Waiting till next April to find out if you're right. Can you just finally just tell us whereabouts people can get hold of your various books?
Sure. Thank you. Prophecyhouse.com. Prophecy. So, ECY, Echo Charlie. Yes. Prophecyhouse, HOUSE.com.
And what about on other platforms like Amazon, etc.?
Well, Amazon has the North Korea book. Not so long ago, I haven't talked about it or done a lot of interviews on it, so it hasn't had a lot of sales yet. But it's North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War. The second edition, The Antichrist and Cup of Tea, will probably be available there in print. The biggest issue I've had with Amazon's platform is they've allowed false reviews, and they refuse to remove them. So if you were to look at North Korea and Iran, that book, it's got two reviews, one five-star and one one-star, and the one-star review is completely fake. Can't get Amazon to remove it so far. So ultimately, I'd like to make it all available through Amazon as well. That will depend on Amazon being more honorable than it's been to this point when I approach them after these other books are out, you know, as they come out.
Tim, you've got to allow a reviewer to criticize as well as, you know, praise you.
Oh, I don't mind criticism. I'm talking about outright fake reviews. In other words, where they didn't actually read the book, they're not saying anything that's true about the book. So, for example, there's a fake review on the Antichrist and Cup of Tea posted recently, even after it's been out of print, where they're saying that I, as an author in the book, am praising Islam throughout the book. That's literally what they say. Anyone who reads the book or anything that I've ever posted publicly online knows that's not true. It's the exact opposite of the truth.
Okay, so it's prophecyhouse.com.
Yeah, prophecyhouse.com. And then the North Korea book, the person who wrote a one-line review, if you look at all reviews, and unfortunately Amazon doesn't show comments on reviews automatically anymore, you have to actually click to view all reviews, quote unquote, before you can see the comments that have been posted against individual reviews. So in that one-star review on the North Korea book, there are a couple of people, one of them is Prophecy House, but then some other person, I don't know, who commented on the fact that that was obviously a fake review. So, but you can see that. It's just a matter of people being able to rely on the stars that they're seeing.
Yeah,
so in this case, I'll just say people need to go read the reviews.
Just finally, I've just remembered, very quickly, Tim, can you just give us your take on COVID in literally 2 minutes?
Yes. Okay. So this is a bit of a segue, and just bear with me for a moment, but I will be under your two-minute limit. Some of the material in the upcoming Solar Apocalypse series, which is the one that deals with non-terrestrial life. I deal a lot with science fiction, specifically movies and books and so forth, particularly books and movies and TV shows, dealing with aliens and this kind of thing. And for that, one of the things that I watched was a movie called Shrieker Island, the most recent Tremors movie. I noticed in the text, the script for that movie, some lines that were out of place where they talked about a viral pandemic, an airborne viral pandemic. They talked about, quote unquote, the Pennsylvania Steel and some other lines that directly relate to the election that just occurred in the United States. The movie was filmed more than a year ago. So in other words, the manuscript for the movie was completed more than a year ago. It was filmed more than a year ago. And it was recently released before the election occurred in the United States. But the lines in it, the text, explicitly indicate, and they're out of place for the movie entirely, that there was a plan to have an airborne pandemic and then a quote-unquote Pennsylvania steal. And Nevada is mentioned in some other things that suggest, bizarrely, that there was some plot to use a pandemic virus like COVID as part of enabling this election fraud that has occurred. Now, this is totally different from all the stuff that we hear in the news. But if people were to go to my Parler account, Parlay, at author Tim Cohen, I actually posted those quotes from that movie where they can see what I'm talking about in the exact time segments in that recent movie. That's just bizarre. So all that is to say that and other things suggest to me that the Democrats have used this as another coup attempt to remove President Trump, who opposes a lot of the New World Order agenda. He's kind of an impediment to it. And then the Great Reset thing under Prince Charles and so forth, really with the WEF, World Economic Forum, et cetera, is all part of that as well.
Okay, but do you think people need to be really concerned about COVID-19 and the vaccine?
I think there's no question that the virus is very dangerous, that it's real. I'm not suggesting otherwise. It is a real pandemic. I don't think that everything that's been said about it publicly is true. I do think that some of the vaccines potentially could be very dangerous. We really don't know, particularly the messenger RNA-based vaccines, which are a new technology where they're inserting something into your cells to cause them to produce antibodies. The danger with those vaccines, the mRNA vaccines like the Pfizer and the other one, drawing a blank on the name of the company at the moment. But anyway, the danger is that the messenger RNA they're using is encapsulated in a nanoparticle that's comprised of chemicals that produce an allergic reaction in the body. And what we don't know is how quickly the body purges itself of those chemicals, or even if it does do so. The messenger RNA breaks down very quickly in the body, but we don't know about the chemicals. And secondly, whether people immediately or down the road will have severe anaphylactic type allergic reactions to those nanoparticles themselves. And we don't know the long-term effect of those kinds of vaccines, whether they'll cause some sort of massive genetic damage up to and including, for example, sterilization, if you wanted to get really into conspiratorial type things. So there hasn't been enough time for them to be proven in terms of their safety.
Okay, Tim Cohen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tony.